Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Jamaica, Jamaica, no. Jamaica, Jamaica, yo. Jamaica, Jamaica.
Jamaica's healthcare system is facing a crisis. Some of the island's most highly trained nurses are leaving to take jobs in North America and Europe. The shortage has become so severe that some Jamaican hospitals have postponed complex surgeries. NPR's Jason Bobian reports.
James Moss Solomon, the chairman of the University Hospital of the West Indies in Kingston, says the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom are, in his words, poaching Jamaica's most highly trained nurses. And he says these nurses who are being lured abroad were working on wards where it's very hard to replace them.
Operating theater, intensive care unit, accident and emergency, where nurses are specialized. And this is what the problem is.
Moss Solomon says the exodus is crippling hospitals across Jamaica. Last week, his hospital was forced to cancel some elective surgeries because they didn't have the staff to handle the procedures. The starting salary for a nurse in Jamaica is less than $8,000 a year. With some specialized training and working overtime, she, and it is almost entirely women, could possibly make up to $20,000 a year on the island. Foreign staffing agencies are offering more than twice that to come to the U.S. or take a job in London. The head of the Nurses Association of Jamaica, Janet Coeur Farr, says last year about 200 specialist nurses left the country. Jamaica has roughly 4,500 registered nurses, and about 1,000 of them are specialized. Coeur Farr says this hemorrhaging of nursing staff has continued into 2017.
We have in one hospital, which is a 500-bed unit, 10 nurses left and more are leaving, and these nurses are trained in accident and emergency.
Coeur Farr says as more and more nurses leave, the workload gets even heavier for those who stay behind. She says many nurses in Jamaica are now regularly expected to work double shifts, which might make some of them think about taking a job in Phoenix or Toronto.
There's no retention strategy for the nurses who are here. And we feel, quite frankly, that nobody cares. So what? If they go, no big thing. But it's a serious problem.
The Minister of Health, however, says he does recognize what a huge problem the island is facing with the loss of nurses. In the short term, Jamaica is bringing in 25 nurses next month from Cuba to help staff some of their wards, and they have plans to try to recruit nurses from India and the Philippines in what's become a crazy global race to snap up healthcare professionals. Jason Bobien, NPR News.
You took that book, Mom?
Son, I pay taxes.
The taxes pay for everything in that library. You can't take something you already paid for. Fortran is a new and exciting language used by programmers to communicate with computers. It is exciting as it is the wave of the future.
We're going to talk about Hidden Figures for just a few more minutes. The movie is just out this weekend, but it is already a hit with young women of color who are interested in science, technology, and math.
So my name is Sasha Williams. I am 15 years old.
Let's just say Sasha is a fan.
That was one of the best movies I've ever seen. It was a really inspiring movie. It was so interesting to see women who look like me during that time period do something that I am interested in doing in my life.
Sasha lives in Danville, California, and she's a member of the Oakland chapter of Black Girls Code. That's a group that supports young women of color who want to learn more about coding. Kimberly Bryant founded the group.
Our goal is to really have young women of color embrace the tech marketplace and the tech innovation space as both leaders and creators.
Over the next week, Black Girls Code is taking some 1,500 young girls and their families from 11 chapters nationwide to see the movie for free as part of a project they're calling Future Katherine Johnsons. It's sponsored in part by 20th Century Fox, the studio behind the film.
Mr. Zielinski, I'm a Negro woman. I'm not going to entertain the impossible.
And I'm a Polish Jew whose parents died in a Nazi prison camp. Now I'm standing beneath a spaceship that's going to carry an astronaut to the stars. Let me ask you, if you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
But some of the girls couldn't wait for that to see it. Budding coder Kaya Morton lives in San Francisco, and she says she was really inspired by Dorothy Vaughn, played by Octavia Spencer.
She's one of the main characters, and she kind of started as a computer.
But Kai liked that Dorothy Vaughn taught herself the coding language, Fortran.
And that's kind of how they kind of survived within NASA, and instead of losing their jobs when IBM started bringing in the actual computers. So I thought that was amazing to see, like, that these stories are so true and just the words are so powerful and the message behind it.
Kai is 17 years old and applying to colleges now, looking at computer science and gaming development degrees. But she's daunted by what lies ahead.
So I'm going to a school in the Bay Area right next to Silicon Valley, but always there's going to be people that look at you weird because they don't really think that you can do what they can because you don't really fit the image of the typical white male geek, and that's kind of harmful.
But she says the movie gave her confidence a boost.
Probably was the most amazing thing and, like, best message about the movie, that there's so many people we don't see in the mainstream media, but when we kind of take a deeper look, we can see how much people like Katherine Johnson can make a difference, but be behind closed doors for a long part of their lives and lifespan.
And Sasha Williams agrees.
I just hope it inspires anyone to know that they can overcome barriers no matter who's in their way, and they can achieve what they're trying to do.
That's Sasha Williams, aged 15, and Kai Morton, aged 17, young coders in training who say they are inspired by the movie Hidden Figures, out in theaters now.
Quinton Morris wants to give back. He's a violin virtuoso who teaches at Seattle University. He's one of only two tenured African-American professors of violin in the U.S. Morris grew up in Renton and remembers the support he got from the community. He says that support is important for people of color who want to enter the world of classical music. Morris told KUOW's race and inequity reporter Jamala Henderson that teachers at North Carolina College tried to discourage him from pursuing his passion.
You're really connected to your Black roots. You should consider, you know, teaching high school, but you'll never become a professional violinist. And by this point, I want to maybe play Carnegie Hall one day, maybe have a career as a professional violinist. Totally discouraged from teachers who said, no, you can't, you won't. And one just flat out telling me, Black violinists are, there's very few, and I don't see a career for you in that.
As this person who is powerful, who has now this power to inspire other younger generations, what are the challenges now for kids of color, African Americans who want to play classical music?
I think there are several, and I'm going to speak specifically about this area. South King County, Renton, Auburn, Federal Way, Tukwila, Kent, Maple Valley, there are not enough resources.
What kind of resources are you talking about? What's missing from all these places?
From an artistic standpoint, One is music lessons. There's no one that's reaching out to South King County and saying, hey, we care about you and you are valuable and you have every right to take lessons.
You're going to be opening two violin studios,
yeah,
and in Renton and Maple Valley, and you're targeting low income and, you know, high school kids of color.
I'm targeting everyone. I'm really interested in students of color, but you have to be at least in middle school because that's the age when kids want to quit. You're in the seventh grade. You're in the eighth grade. You're a male walking through the hallway with your violin. Hello, I did it. And you get teased because it's not cool. That's the target group I want. Girls, you know, girls don't get teased for playing a violin. Boys do. You know, would I like for them all to become virtuosos? Sure. But the purpose of taking violin lessons from my studio is not only to progress and become a better player, but it's also to develop critical thinking skills. It builds leadership. It builds so many life skills. I want to create and help develop strong leaders.
What does music give you that you couldn't otherwise get? And what do you hope that music will give these children?
I feel like at this stage in my career and in my life, what good is it if I can't give back? I have traveled literally around the world. I have all this expertise. I've done 3 Carnegie Hall sold-out recitals. I'm a tenured music professor at Seattle U. What good is it if I have all of this, these resources and this wealth, if students who look up to me or aspire to be like me or aspire to be something great don't have access to it?
That's Quentin Morris. He's opening violin music studios in Renton and Maple Valley that will focus on low-income students of color. He spoke with KUAW's race and inequity reporter, Jamala Henderson. KUAW will explore how racial inequity shapes the Seattle region in the coming months.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Extra patrol cars outside of Annapolis High School. Police ensuring students are safe during arrival and dismissal. The increased security after school officials say several tweets from a Twitter account called KKK for Real threatened to blow up the school. A different Twitter account from a group called Cool Kids Klan KKK made similar threats against Arundel High School, with some tweets specifically targeting black students. School officials say last week, students here at Arundel High signed a petition to join the group. That letter was confiscated by school staff and turned over to police.
We don't think that there's any credibility to this threat. Any threats we take very seriously, especially threats to our school. Our student safety here in Anne Arundel County is a major priority.
The Anne Arundel County Public Schools superintendent and principals of both high schools sent letters to parents condemning the threats and discrimination, but some are still uneasy.
I think that they should have sent the students home and make me want to take my son home now.
Should parents be worried?
Parents should be worried and should be talking to their children about their children's fears, but should also be assured that we are doing everything in conjunction with county police that we possibly can to keep their children safe in school.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block of your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'.
But a post on Instagram has led to the suspension of a Central Catholic High School student. The school is calling the remarks against an African-American student racist and derogatory. Brenda Waters has more.
It was one of the most absurd things
I've seen.
The Instagram posting allegedly came from a junior at Central Catholic, directed towards a senior at the school who is African American. It reads in part, "You filthy fat expletive, inbred inward.
Nigger!
You literally stay in the cafeteria all day and eat until your heart fills up on gas. You're fat as expletive."
I really didn't think the kid who posted it would write something like that. I didn't know there was that side of him.
It's kind of out of character for this school. Usually, I mean, I'm glad the principal is definitely going to do something about it, because it's just not something you'd expect.
Brother Tony Baginti, the principal at Central Catholic, told me the student who posted the message did it under a fake account, but an investigation pinpointed him.
The principal here at Central Catholic says he is disturbed by the posting, but impressed with the victim's response, as are students here.
I think that he handled it the best way he could. I mean, it's in a case of racism, if you try to handle something with violence, it's only going to lead to more violence. So it's best that he handled it the way he did.
The student who was targeted responded to the Instagram by saying, "It's one thing to call me ugly, fat, etc. I could care less about that, but the racial slurs I will not tolerate. People really need to grow up, because that right there is just pure hate. It's pathetic."
The student who posted the Instagram has been suspended for up to 10 days while this incident is being investigated. At that time, an outcome will be determined. In Oakland, Brenda Waters, KDKA TV News.
The visitors who come to Rikers Island are a lifeline for inmates in New York City's notorious, violent jail system. But visiting, it turns out, comes with its own set of risks. Scores of women have been complaining for years that they've been subjected to invasive strip searches when they try to visit a loved one. That's according to an investigation by WNYC and The Intercept, an investigative website. WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez has the story.
Jasmine Quattlebaum used to visit her fiancé at Rikers Island once a week. She knew the routine. She knew that a dog would sniff the line of mostly female visitors exiting the bus. And she knew that some of the women would slip off their underwire bras to avoid setting off metal detectors.
Some girls do that. I'm not going to take my bra off and put it in my bag just so I won't be. I know the process, so I go there with no earrings, nothing else on, let them pat me down, and I go about my business.
The pat frisk is what happens when a visitor sets off a metal detector or when officers think a visitor might be carrying contraband. It's the most invasive search allowed on Rikers, and visitors are supposed to sign a consent form beforehand. The officer pats the length of the visitor's body over their clothes, including the crotch. They run fingers around their collar and around their waistband, too. Seams, hemlines, and pockets also get checked. It's always conducted by an officer of the same gender as a visitor. But Quattlebaum says things went much further one summer day in 2015 when she stepped behind a curtain with a female officer she had never seen before.
She spinned around searching the waistline, but she was searching up under the panty line, too. So as I came back to the front, that's when she pulled forward, and I'm going down to, close my pants, and she just took her fingers, and just shoved it in my coochie. I'm like, "Miss, what are you doing? That's violation. Where's the privacy?" I'm like, "That's not how the search goes."
That's what scores of women have been saying for years. They've filed lawsuits and complained to prosecutors and regulators.
"Hello, and thank you for calling 311 in New York City."
They've even called into 311, the city line normally reserved for routine calls about noise or potholes, to say they've been violated by female guards. The line has received at least 83 such complaints since 2010, according to records obtained by WNYC and The Intercept under the state Freedom of Information law. A month after Quattlebaum was searched, someone called 311 to complain that a female correction officer forced her to remove her pants and underwear and then touched her vagina and buttocks. The next day, another woman said a correction officer made her pull down her underwear and then removed her sanitary napkin. The following month, 22-year-old Tajiana Cox says the same thing happened to her.
She asked me if I had something on under my pants, and I said, "Yes, I do. I said, I have a pad on," and she asked to see my pad. So I had to pull my underwear down and my vagina and stuff is exposed. And she was like staring at me and it made me feel so uncomfortable.
That day, Cox says she boarded the bus to go home feeling humiliated.
Well, I called my grandma at first when I was on the bus and I told her what happened because I was crying and stuff on the phone. And she told me that I need to report that like right now.
In the past, the city's Department of Correction has had to pay expensive class action legal settlements as a result of illegal strip searches of defendants and inmates. $50 million in 2001, $30 million in 2005. Our investigation found that visitors often get viewed through that same lens of suspicion. Elias Husamuddin, president of the union that represents the city's 10,000 correction officers, says visitors attempt to smuggle in all kinds of contraband.
K2, marijuana, tobacco, scalpels, heroin, cocaine, prescription drugs, you name it, they bring it in.
Officials say the number of weapons attributed to visitors spiked sixfold last year after the city started an amnesty program that allows visitors to leave contraband behind on the city bus that brings them to the island. Illegal drugs and weapons lead to brutal violence. Last fiscal year, there were on average 30 fights a day, creating pressure on officers to find contraband. Husamuddin believes that the women who say they've been invasively searched are lying in order to get effective correction officers removed from their posts.
These allegations are nothing new. Usually they're made by visitors and inmates against officers who are very diligent, thorough at doing their job, and end up catching them or the inmates trying to bring in contraband.
The city says 336 visitors were arrested last year, mostly for contraband. That's out of more than 200,000 jail visits. But the city has acknowledged that correction officers are also a big part of the smuggling problem. In 2014, the inspector general admonished the agency for failing to monitor its own employees. Just last month, a correction officer was arrested for smuggling in alcohol, a cell phone, and 8 packages of marijuana and tobacco. Nothing was found on Jasmine Quattlebaum, but when she resisted the search, she was arrested anyway and charged with harassment and obstructing governmental administration.
They're still trying to get me to take that plea for that, and I'm not taking nothing.
In addition to Quattlebaum, at least 27 other women are already in the process of suing. WNYC checked court data and found none had contraband arrests on their record. Alan Figman represents most of these women. He believes the searches rise to the level of sexual assault, and he says several of his clients have been interviewed by the Bronx District Attorney's Office, which has jurisdiction over Rikers.
Some women wind up totally naked, standing next to their clothing in a pile, and the women all have the same thing in common. When they talk about the event, they're reduced to tears.
A spokeswoman for DA Darcel Clark confirmed that 8 of Figman's clients have been interviewed and declined further comment. The inspector general for the Department of Correction recommended more cameras in search areas. They were installed late last year. The correction department itself says all complaints of sexual abuse are referred to the agency's internal investigations unit, while they wouldn't say whether any officers have been disciplined, citing confidentiality rules. They would say that several claims were found to be false. In the last 7 years, 84 women have also complained to the Board of Corrections, which oversees city jails.
Good afternoon. My name is Vivian Velasquez, and I'm going to
At a hearing in July, Velasquez described how a correction officer took her into a bathroom and made her pull down her underwear while her 7-year-old grandson stood nearby facing the wall.
I have my monthly cycle. They made me take off what I had under my panties, throw it out, and again, my grandson was listening to this.
But by the time she spoke, most of the board members were gone.
It's so surprising how everybody left the room. You know, like, we don't matter. And that's the same thing what happens when we go on a visit. We don't matter. The COs run the show.
She told those who were left,
things really need to change. Thank you.
For WNYC, I'm Cindy Rodriguez.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
There's a lot of artwork hanging in the halls of the U.S. Capitol building. Tour groups might stop to look, but mostly the portraits and paintings go relatively unnoticed. Except for one. It's a painting by a high school student, and it has launched a back and forth in Congress over free speech, artistic expression, and policing. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis has more.
The art in question hangs in this well-trafficked underground Capitol hallway. It's one of hundreds of works of art on display right now as part of the annual High School Congressional Art Competition. The artist, David Polfus, is now in college. He was a high school student in Missouri Democrat William Lacy Clay's district that includes the town of Ferguson. Here's Clay on his constituents' painting.
It's a collage of different scenes that this kid has experienced over the last 5 years.
The street scene depicts dozens of black protesters. One is holding a sign that says, "Racism kills." And at the foreground of this collage, two uniformed cops are depicted with animal heads. The painting had been hanging here since June, without controversy or incident. But a wave of criticism in recent weeks from conservative media outlets prompted criticism from law enforcement advocates. That prompted one Republican to take matters into his own hands.
Congressman Duncan Hunter, who took it upon himself to remove the painting without any authority from the architect of the Capitol.
Hunter removed the painting from the wall and delivered it back to Clay's office last Friday. Hunter says the painting is offensive, and it violates existing rules governing what's acceptable art in the Capitol complex. He makes no apologies for his actions.
It was something that had to be done.
It had to be done.
Yeah. So I just did it.
Clay reported Hunter to Capitol Police. He wants him charged with theft, but says the police declined to pursue it. Clay held a ceremony yesterday to reinstall it. He was joined by members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
This is really not about a student art competition anymore. It's about defending the Constitution.
The painting was taken down by Republican lawmakers two additional times on Tuesday. Clay hung it back up each time. Washington Republican Dave Reichert, a former sheriff, is asking the architect of the Capitol to review the painting and whether it violates any rules. Reichert objects to the art, but he had been trying to find a more peaceful resolution.
You know, look, I was a cop for 33 years, and that's not how you solve problems.
The painting is scheduled to come down no matter what this summer, when the next round of winning high school art goes up for display. And maybe debate. Susan Davis, NPR News, the Capitol.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
So something caught my attention, you know, just before the holidays. I wrote about it for the Toronto Star, where, as you know, I am a columnist every other Thursday. And, you know, I had to write about this story because it immediately caught my attention when it was in the news. And it was all over the news before Christmas. It's a story of a bank robber. Mundane so far, I know. People rob banks. What's the big deal? Well, the person robbing banks in this case was doing it in a very brazen way, walking in to locations on Yonge Street, five different branches over the course of about a week or 10 days or something, and walking into banks without a mask, without anything concealing his face, going up to the teller, handing them a note saying he had a gun, and demanding money. Now, the police don't know who this person is, and as far as I know, they still haven't arrested them. But they held a press conference in order to say, hey, there's this person robbing banks on Yonge Street. Brazenly. No attempt to cover his face. Just walking in and taking the money and leaving. But what was very interesting about the way that the police decided to describe this individual was that certain things kept coming up. Now, as a young man who's doing this, and they have security footage of him, of course, because he doesn't cover his face, and he seems to be quite young, and he is white, and I'm going to explain why I am mentioning that to you shortly. But police started focusing on really interesting things about this young robber, like the fact that he apparently wears nice clothing. This was in police reports. This was in statements by the police. The police inspector who was on this case, Mike Earle, described the young person as being preppy. Talked about his good clothes. It went on. I have actually a clip from Mike Earle, the police inspector who was tasked with doing this press conference about this young bank robber. Here is part of what he said about those notes that the robber writes when he says, "Give me all your money or I'll shoot you." Yeah. So here's Mike Earle describing those notes that the bank robber has been using.
In every case, police say the suspect would walk into the bank, produce a note demanding cash, and indicate that he had a gun. The head of the holdup squad, who has investigated hundreds of these bank robberies, says the so-called lunchtime bandit appears to have paid attention in school.
And the notes, my understanding, are well written with proper grammar, which tells me that he very well may be, maybe he's never been in trouble before.
Yeah. I mean, his grammar is so good when he writes the holdup notes. Maybe he's never been in trouble before, says a veteran of the Toronto Police. Now, just to give you a little bit more of an idea of how far Mike Earle, the police inspector in this case, wanted to go to kind of create an excuse for this young, apparently preppy, white robber. They kept saying he was clean shaven. Mike Earle used the term clean shaven many, many times. Why all of the defensiveness about this young person committing crimes? But Mike Earle went on, and here's a quote from that same press conference. "Maybe he is an educated individual, and this is his only hope to get some kind of money." This is from the police inspector. So he's preppy, he has great grammar, nice clothing, just poor down on his luck guy going into banks and saying, "Give me your money or I have a gun." Now, this is not always the way that the police talk about bank robbers or people who commit crime in general. I wrote a piece about this in the Toronto Star saying that this defensiveness was really notable because it almost sounded like Mike Earle was talking about his nephew. Poor young kid who got himself in over his head, doesn't know what he's doing robbing banks. 2 days after the press conference that I'm telling you about, Mike Earle came back out again. This time, a different investigation, but also one involving armed robbery suspects. I want you to listen how that same inspector, Mike Earle, described the black suspects in this case of bank robbery 48 hours after he talked about the preppy punk, as he called him.
A series of robberies, approximately 50 robberies, armed robberies that occurred starting in May of 2016, and the investigation is still ongoing by a group of, I call, pathetic parasites that have been plaguing the community.
Pathetic parasites that have been plaguing the community, said Mike Earle about a group of black men. The white guy was preppy. The white guy had good clothing and good grammar. The white guy, according to Mike Earle, was just an educated individual who had only no hope of getting any money except for robbing people in banks. Contrast that with parasites who are plaguing the city. You hear the references to disease. And again, just filling in from other parts of this press conference and other statements that Earle said about this particular group of black men, He said that they were like they were spreading like a bad smell in the GTA. Why the difference, Inspector Earle? Why is one of these people worthy of our consideration and even sympathy for the understanding of their crimes, and the other are not even human? You call them parasites. This is how racism sounds in the 21st century in Toronto. It's right out there in the open for people to see. It's Phil in Oakville who's called in. Hello, Phil.
Hey, Desmond. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
I love your show. And I can see where you're going with this. And like as I told your caller, I'm going to agree with you because it just shows because I'm not white myself. And I'm of Latin background, and this just continues to prove in the 21st century how this systemic racism and racial profiling in our justice system continues to permeate our society. I mean, as you're saying, blacks, you know, they cross them off with every, you know, with every cuss word they can find, but the poor little white guy here, as you said, poor little white guy, let's find an excuse for him. It's just, it's sickening that, you know, in this 21st century that, you know, if you're not white, you're still being marginalized and practically chased out of town. You know, same crime, but because he's white, let's find an excuse. If he's black, run him out of town.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. The job of the police is to apprehend people who are committing crimes. So describing somebody as a parasite because you believe that they're involved in crime is not your job as a police officer. Now, some of you out there will disagree with me, and some of you, act very outraged about crime, particularly when it's being committed by black people, and you want to say, well, if they committed the crime, what do you want us to call them? What nice things do you want us to say about them? But you can see here that not every person who commits armed robbery in the city of Toronto is worthy of being called a parasite in the eyes of your police. That description was saved for the black men in the city of Toronto. And time was, you know, a long time back when I heard something like this, I would have said, fire the police inspector who made these racist comments. But he's not the problem. The problem is that we have a City of Toronto police force that puts him out there to say these racist, disgusting things.
Last Sunday, we invited a panel of comedians for a year in review program. It's what we call our look back and laughter. But in one of the segments, we looked at a number of photos that caught our attention over the course of the year. And in that segment, I asked my guests to provide kind of off the cuff ideas for captions of the photos that we were seeing. Among the images we aired was one of the Romney family that showed Governor Mitt Romney's grandchildren, including his adopted grandson, who is African-American. Now, given my own family history, I'd identified with that picture, and I intended to say positive and celebratory things about it. But whatever the intent was, the reality is that the segment proceeded in a way that was offensive, and showing the photo in that context of that segment was poor judgment. So without reservation or qualification, I apologize to the Romney family. My intention was not malicious, but I broke the ground rule that families are off limits, and for that I am sorry. Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption, because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
We've been sharing a series of conversations with you over the last few weeks, hosted by our friend Rebecca Carroll. Rebecca is a special projects producer for WNYC Radio, and she's black, but her identity is actually more complicated than that.
I am adopted. I was adopted into a white family.
Well, Rebecca doesn't speak a lot publicly about her adoption story, but then last summer, a group called PACT, that specializes in interracial adoption, called her up and asked her to speak. And she agreed, if reluctantly.
I just thought, like, if my parents had had an opportunity to go to a conference with interracial families and white parents mostly of black and brown kids and shown me that kind of investment, I really so would have appreciated it. And so I thought, okay, let me do this.
She did it. And at the conference, Rebecca met actress Kristen Davis. You might remember her because she played Charlotte in Sex and the City. Kristen Davis was at the conference because a few years ago, she adopted a black child, her daughter Gemma. So Rebecca sat down with Kristen Davis to talk about their experiences with interracial adoption. And it didn't take long before Kristen Davis became emotional about just how much responsibility she has to her daughter.
I am white. I have lived in white privilege. I thought I knew before adopting my daughter that I was in white privilege and that I understood what that meant. But until you actually have a child, which is like your heart being outside you, and that heart happens to be in a brown body, and then you have people who are, you know, actively working against your child, it's hard. It fills me with terror.
Do you feel like... I mean, I feel like the lens, our lenses as women, as mothers, as creators, thinkers, whatever, the entire lens has shifted. Did you ever think, what were you thinking?
We have a really intense and wonderful adoption community of interracially adopted, you know, families. And some of my friends are directors and very creative people. And we do engage in magical thinking. It's part of what we do, you know, and that can lead to problems. Absolutely. When you're living in the real world with your children, I think that we want to make it all good. And, you know, then you start to be slowly stripped away of the fantasy of that and come into the reality of that. And then you just have to work harder. I don't know if that made sense.
It does make sense. And it reminds me, though, of a conversation we had at PACT where, you know, there were a couple of other folks from the Hollywood community. And I had said, I don't know if I articulated it in this way, but y'all have adopted black children. So I imagine that you are about racial justice. And so why do I not see you, you know, out there on your platforms talking about racial justice? And do you remember what you said?
I don't. What did I say, Rebecca? Please tell me.
I don't know that it had occurred to me. I think you said that.
I think that's true. I think that's true. Because, yeah, I just it's a strange thing where you don't necessarily put it all together. I don't know how to put it that way. You know what's inside you, right? And I know my own life, and I know what I saw growing up. I might be working in my own way that might not be so obvious. But then as a white person, and I think we talked about this, right? You then somehow feel like, oh my God, am I allowed to do it? Because yes, I have adopted this black child, which some people know and some people don't, because I try to keep her out of the spotlight. But like someone the other day on Twitter said something like, you know, well, what do you know about it or something? And I was like, oh God.
Well, you were like, I know a lot about it. Or somewhat about it. I mean,
right. See, that's where you get into the toughie.
Right.
I do and I don't. I mean, I'm on the intense learning curve because I have to protect my child.
So, speaking of language and the role that you're best known for, and that I didn't watch it for that very reason, that I felt that there was not a person or a situation that reflected my experience. And also the other thing is that growing up in a white family, in a white town, in white schools, you know, the one thing that I really struggled with was the standard of beauty, right? Who was chosen and who was not chosen. And so, you know, the day that Gemma watches Sex and the City, what do you say?
I don't know if I can say what I'm going to say publicly.
Oh.
Because, you know that we tried behind the scenes. And I don't want to say anything negative because I care about everybody involved. But, you know, we weren't as successful as we wanted to be. But we did try. I would say something to that effect because it's true. And I would say, I'm sorry.
And how do you talk to her about her beauty?
My child looks beautiful and fantastic in her camo outfit and her mohawk and her everything. I always tell her that because I have to tell her that. I have to tell her your curls are beautiful. Your black skin is beautiful. You're beautiful. You're powerful. You're a goddess. And you've seen her. She is.
I mean, she certainly is. But at the same time, she's looking at you and she's like, well, mommy, you're white and you look like everybody that I see on TV or in magazines or whatever, you know. I mean, not that she looks at magazines.
No, because we work really hard at that. That's one area, I think, because of what I do, that I was really hyper aware of. Because I know what I grew up looking at in the magazines, and I felt less than, you know, because that's what they want you to feel. So, like, you know, Serena is a household fixture at our house. This is a funny thing I went through, too. I think I told you that we had gone to this school near my house as a preschool that was like this hippie preschool. It was a co-op. It was like very granola, LA granola, you know. And we go, and I'm like, oh my God, they're all blonde. Like, literally blonde. Like, there's, like, nobody of anything, really. And then I would talk to the teachers, and they say, oh, they don't know. They don't know. And it was good, though, because it was a way wake-up call for me. Because I thought, it's hippie, it's love. You know, the Pollyanna thing that we white folks do sometimes. So anyway, we're there, and, you know, some bullying happened with this one child who would systematically save the swing and not let my child on it, even though my child was waiting. And then she would hold it. She would say, I'm holding it. And she would call different white girls to come be on the swing. So this got to the point where I ended up in the office screaming like a crazy, crazy person because it never was handled. It was never handled with that one particular child. And they said to me in the room, they said, well, you know, it's not racial. Mm. And I was like, well, look, I did not ask that girl what it was about. And I did not ask my child what she thought it was about. But I can guarantee you at some point my child is going to internalize that as being because she looks different. And there's a lot of studies that say that at this age, they're sorting things. We all teach them to sort the colors and sort the shapes. And why wouldn't they be sorting who looks like who on the playground? And if you're the only one, you know this, obviously. You've lived it and also told us about it at camp. But, you know, it's terrible. And they were like, oh, no, no. We just love them all the same. And I was like, we're out of here. Bye-bye. And that was what set me on the thing of like, I don't want to swear the way I want to swear on your show. But I mean, you know, it really was a very frightening wake up call of the kind of systematic under the covers type racism that's happening at all times.
That's actress Kristen Davis in conversation with Rebecca Carroll, special projects editor at WNYC. If you want to hear their full conversation, you can get it on our website at thetakeaway.org.
I'm sorry, so sorry.
Forgiveness figures into our next story as well, but bear with me a minute. You see, people here in Boston are curious to see how Hollywood has handled one of our city's biggest traumas, the Boston Marathon bombing of 2013 and the manhunt for the perpetrators, the Tsarnaev brothers. The movie is called Patriots Day, and it opened in Boston today. But our story is not about the Tsarnaevs. It's about one of the actors, a local kid made good. Mark Wahlberg. You might not know it, but Wahlberg's youth, growing up in a tough Boston neighborhood, was anything but good. WGBH reporter Philip Martin has been digging into his background and just met with Wahlberg. Philip, first tell me about Wahlberg's teenage years. They're kind of rough.
Carol, basically you have two Mark Wahlbergs. Mark Wahlberg of the 1980s, he came up in a part of the city called Dorchester, a white working class area, that suddenly a number of immigrants were arriving, many of them from Vietnam, but it also had black residents. And at 16 in 1988, during an attempted robbery, he beat up a Vietnamese man with a wooden stick and knocked him unconscious. Later that same day, while hiding out from the police, he punched another immigrant from Vietnam and basically peppered him with a lot of racially derogatory terms directed at Asians. And this fellow named Nam Pham, who's a leader in Dorchester's 8,000-strong Vietnamese community, who now works for our governor, he's all too familiar with the term.
I first came to Dorchester in 1981, and once in a while I would run into people who told my face, go home, gook. It was very common.
You have to remember, this was a time of busing, and there was a major white backlash, and Mark Wahlberg was part of that backlash.
Did Mark Wahlberg end up spending any time in jail for beating up these guys?
He pled guilty to the 1988 assault on Ho Johnny Tran. He was sentenced to 2 years, but he only served 45 days. 2 years ago, Mark Wahlberg applied for an unconditional pardon for the acts he committed in the 1980s. But both the former governor and the current governor declined to act on it. But I can tell you, he's still very self-conscious about his past. And he's trying to make up for it through charitable work with the Boys and Girls Club.
But what about Wahlberg's victims? What happened to them, and what do they think about Wahlberg these days?
One victim was an African-American woman who was no more than 13 in the 1980s when she was physically attacked by Wahlberg. She's declined press interviews but says she has never forgiven Mark Wahlberg. However, the fellow I referred to earlier, Johnny Ho Tran, who now lives in Texas, a Vietnamese immigrant, he told the Daily Mail a year ago that he does forgive Wahlberg. But Nam Phan, the former head of Viet Aid in Dorchester, says he's come up with a novel way that Mark Wahlberg can repay his debt.
He's a big movie star. We all believe in second chance. Perhaps he can make a movie talking about race. A man from Dorchester who was a troublemaker and now try to make things better for everybody, making our neighborhood, I think that would be a wonderful thing to do.
So is Wahlberg interested in such an idea?
I know it sounds far-fetched, but interestingly, I finally had a chance to ask Mark Wahlberg what he thought of this idea, and this is what he told me.
Well, I'd have to figure out who was going to play me in the movie first. That would be the toughest task. You know, growing up in Boston, especially in the 70s and the 80s, there was a huge racial divide. It was pretty much all we knew growing up. And as far as telling my own story, and, you know, these are things that I've worked hard every day to become a better person, a better father, and a better husband, and a better Bostonian. So the last act of my story is yet to be written, so we'll figure that out. But, you know, I am very, very proud to be a Bostonian, to be a part of this story. So,
actor Mark Wahlberg speaking there with my WGBH colleague Philip Martin.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? White genetic annihilation. All these people from Syria coming up in here.
A far-right politician is leading the polls in the Netherlands, which holds a general election in March. Geert Wilders promises to ban Muslim immigrants. A new Dutch political party founded by immigrants plans to fight his agenda. Lauren Freyer reports from Amsterdam.
Sylvana Siemens got her start at the Dutch version of MTV. She went on to anchor the evening news and did Dancing with the Stars.
Here is Sylvana met Rhythm Nation.
Siemens is black, and she's spoken out against the Dutch Christmas tradition of Black Piet, in which Santa's helper is often played by a white person in blackface. That prompted someone to make a spoof music video about her. Oh, Sylvana, why don't you pack your bags and leave this country, the video says. Then someone photoshopped pictures of her face onto old photos of lynching victims from the American South. Siemens filed a police complaint, quit her media job, and went into politics, as she told reporters in a rare interview in early December.
I have made this conscious decision to enter politics because I feel that we are not just fighting racist people one by one. What we need is a change of the system.
At first, Siemens joined a new Dutch political party called Denk, or Think. Its candidates include a Muslim woman who wears a headscarf, people of Turkish and Moroccan descent, and black people like Siemens. All of them say they've felt left out of Dutch politics, especially now that the far-right anti-Muslim leader Geert Wilders is surging in the polls. Sociologist Sandu Hira says that while Wilders seeks votes by stirring up fear of immigrants, Denk seeks votes from the victims, whom Holland has failed to truly integrate.
People of color are not recognized as proper Dutch. And there is where the anger is from people who are seen as second-class citizens while they were born here. And that is the generation of Denk.
Denk wants to establish a national racism register to track hate speech, build a slavery museum in the Netherlands, and ban Black Piet. The party was founded 2 years ago by two Turkish Dutchmen who had dropped out of the Labour Party. I ran into some Denk voters on the sidelines of a youth soccer game. One of the dads, Bulent Ojturk, points out his son on the blue team.
If you look, the orange team, they're only Dutch. And the blue team, foreign. And Turkish and American kids, mainly.
Because you're talking about your son, who is the third generation.
Yeah.
But you still call him a foreigner.
We are foreigners, yeah.
Ojturk still doesn't feel like he belongs in Dutch society nearly 50 years after his parents came to work here in the 1960s.
They came to do jobs that Dutch people wouldn't like to do or that they couldn't find the people to do. So they were very welcome. But I don't feel like at home here anymore.
So he says he plans to vote for Denk in the election this March. But the party has had some problems. Siemens recently split with Denk. The party almost always refuses media interviews and puts out YouTube videos instead. Critics say those are similar tactics to the far right, putting the focus on identity politics and victimhood. Alexander Pechtold is parliamentary leader of the left-wing D66 party.
It's almost the extremist opposite of what Wilders is doing. It's not inclusive. It's not looking for coalitions who want to really solve problems. No.
Denk has also been accused of being a mouthpiece of Turkey because two of its founders are Dutch Turks. But that accusation itself reveals how some Dutch see immigrants as loyal to another country. About 1 million of Holland's 17 million citizens are immigrants, their children or their grandchildren, a potentially powerful group of voters at the polls this March. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Amsterdam.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of...
Time again for StoryCorps, and today we're remembering a man who fought for the right to vote in Mississippi and was murdered for it. His name is Vernon Dahmer, and he was a civil rights leader in the mid-1960s. At the time, people were still required to pay a poll tax in Mississippi when they registered to vote. Dahmer, who was a successful farmer and businessman, publicly offered to pay that tax for Black Americans who couldn't afford it. When Dahmer's house was firebombed by the KKK, his wife and three of his children were inside. His widow, Ellie Dahmer, and their daughter, Betty Dahmer, who was just 10 at the time, came to StoryCorps to remember that night.
We didn't think anybody would bother the children, but we were wrong. They intended to get all of us January 10, 1966, that night. When I waked up, the house was on fire, and it was so bright and so hot. You were screaming to the top of your voice, "Lord, have mercy, we're going to get burned up in this house alive." I raised the windows up, and then your father was handing you out the window to me.
We escaped to the barn to hide, and I can remember us sitting on the bales of hay. I had burns over a good portion of my body, and I was screaming and crying because I was in pain. Daddy was burned so much worse than I was. When he held up his arm, the skin just hung down. But Daddy never did complain. He was just concerned about me. I remember us going to the hospital.
You was in the room with your father. I was sitting between the two beds. And he yelled my name real loud. And then he was gone. He knew that he might get killed. And he was willing to take the risk. But it was not worth it to me. I miss him so much.
Daddy wasn't a man that wore a suit. He wore overalls. In Daddy's world, everybody had a job to do. Black people couldn't vote. So I do understand why he did what he did. It meant a lot to him.
Some of the last words he said was, "If you don't vote, you don't count." That's on his tombstone. We made a tremendous sacrifice, Betty. I try to go on and live my life without thinking about it. But it's a night I can never forget. It has been over 50 years, and it seemed like it was yesterday.
The voice of Ellie Dahmer, remembering her husband Vernon Dahmer, with their daughter Betty at StoryCorps in Mississippi. More than 30 years later, the KKK leader who ordered Vernon's killing was convicted of his murder. Ellie went on to serve as an election commissioner in Hattiesburg. Their interview is part of the StoryCorps archive at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
There's a second threat to our democracy, and this one is as old as our nation itself. After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say.
Damn you, Obama.
Is coming under fire after the owner posted a picture that went viral. It showed President Obama with a target and bullseye over his face with words celebrating the end of his term. 7 News reporter Aaron Rodgers has the story.
When I first pulled up, I couldn't believe it, really.
Ann Smith says she frequents not your average thrift store in Belton. But when she went on Friday, she saw a sign that usually isn't there.
It made me feel awful.
This is a picture of what the owner, who goes by Mike, posted outside. A poster board with the words, 16 days until Obama's demise. Language and images multiple people we heard from say are disrespectful.
Then you draw a picture of a bullseye, and then you put the little black dot in it where you basically like you want to shoot him or do something like that. So, of course, that made me feel bad because as of right now, he's still our president.
A picture taken of the sign and posted online went viral, which led to comments on both sides of the issue from the community and across the country. But when the owner responded to one online comment with the N-word,
nigga,
that got people upset.
I was shocked. I couldn't even believe it.
The owner of Not Your Average Thrift Store did not want to be interviewed, but he did tell me he agrees that his sign could be seen as disrespectful, but he says he will not apologize for using the N-word. The owner also told me it's not fair how his business is being treated because of his right to free speech. But his customers say that's not the problem.
That's how he felt? That's fine.
Smith says she just wishes he would have kept it out of his business and says she won't be going back.
So now you lose my business. And we spend a lot of money in that store.
In Belton, Erin Rogers, 7 News.
We checked with Belton police and they told us that they did not receive any complaints about the sign, which has now been removed.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
For that reason.
Realistically, Professor Shealy, if
he's
he got
sentenced
death for Dylan Roof has just gotten the death penalty. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you a question that really doesn't is not pertinent now. So how long before he will actually be put to death, Professor Shealy? I mean, will it be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20
appeals?
Years?
Oh, yes. There will be appeals. And let me say that since 1988, and there was a 16-year moratorium on the death penalty in the federal system as of 1988, but since 1988, three people have been put to death in the federal system. And one was a volunteer. That took 6 years. And the other two who maintained their appeals went about 8 years. So if past is prologue in any way, that may be what we're looking at. My guess is it could take... this one may move quicker. I believe that this trial is very clean. There are very few serious legal issues here, in my opinion. So you could look at 5 to 6 years very easily, I think, if appeals move and reviews move in the normal process.
At a minimum, perhaps.
Perhaps, yes.
Go live to Lisa Wiseman, who is live outside the federal courthouse in downtown Charleston. Lisa?
Hey, Debbie. Yeah, we are expecting after that word that Dylan Roof will be put to death. He's been sentenced to death. We are expecting family members who are inside of the courtroom right now to come outside and speak to the media. A lot of them have been very quiet since these proceedings began. We had a chance to talk with some of them after he was found guilty last month. They said that they would not be making a statement until the guilt phase of this trial is over. Now that we do know that Dylan Roof will be put to death, we are expecting them to come out, at least some of them, and express what they've been thinking. And I got to tell you, in the courtroom today during the closing arguments, prosecutor so walked us through that morning, or excuse me, that night of June 17, 2015. They took us back into the basement of Mother Emanuel, figuratively as well as literally. They showed us those crime scene photos again. And this time around, though, this has been the third time that personally, as a reporter, that I've seen these photos inside of the courtroom. Of course, once when they were entered into evidence, another time during the closing arguments of the guilt phase, and again today, I got to tell you that it seemed like the shock value has somewhat worn off for those jury members as well as members of the victim's family before the first and second time that they saw these pictures. A lot of the family members were just crumpled over in grief during recess. A lot of them couldn't even move. They wouldn't stand up. They simply stayed put, comforting one another. That was not the case today. The jurors were very intent, even when Dylan Roof stood just feet in front of them, making one final plea for his life this morning, as we know that now that the jury has decided that he will be put to death for the murders of those nine people inside of Mother Emanuel. And we look for our Carter Coyle and Karina Bolster. They are inside of the courthouse right now. Our Carter is inside of the courtroom, and Karina is inside of a media room where she's allowed to have those devices. But it'll be interesting to note really what Carter says when it comes to those family members, if they made any sort of a noise. I know when the jury came back last month for the guilt phase, many of them remained quiet as well. And so it'll be interesting to see if that was the case as well today. And we are expecting, of course, that those family members to come out here. We do have an extra camera set up, so we won't miss them. But with that, we'll send it back to you.
All right. So we understand Dylan Roof now has been given the death penalty. Professor, now that we know that, this is Professor Miller Sheely from the Charleston School of Law. I'm here with Debbie Chard. Now that we know Dylan Roof has been given the death penalty, does that mean perhaps that prosecutor Solicitor Scarlett Wilson might think twice about trying him again on state charges?
Well, it's always within her discretion. But I go back to all that's been said in the press and been made clear to the public, is that the state has every intention of retrying this case. Obviously, there will be discussions with the victims and federal prosecutors, and there's nothing binding. The solicitor can decide to do whatever she wishes to do. But so far, the state has insisted that it will go forward.
What's the point, though, really, Debbie and Professor, if you've given somebody the death penalty, what's the point of trying him again and getting perhaps another death penalty?
Well, that's a good question. But the answer is, given the outrageous and heinous nature of this case, if you get two death penalties, it's more likely that you're going to get one than get none.
New information coming in. Dylan Roof is apparently asking for a retrial with new lawyers. Is that going to be heard?
Well, the judge will consider it. I think the judge will promptly deny that. So I understand. He's probably being told, as he should be, by his attorneys, do this, make this motion, because he's still trying the case. So there's certain motions you have to make technically at the close of each case, like a directed verdict motion. That's what he's doing. He has to do that to preserve his rights of appeal.
Apparently, the judge is going to hear that case tomorrow, that motion tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
Right.
So
9:30 in the morning.
9:30.
Now, in case you're just joining us, I'm here with Debbie and Professor Miller Sheely, and the verdict came in about 20 minutes ago. It is death for Dylan Roof, the church shooter at Mother Emanuel, the man who admitted that he killed nine people during Bible study in June of 2015. We're talking about now where we go from here, and Professor Sheely, Debbie, seems to indicate that at this point, prosecutor, Solicitor Scarlett Wilson, is going ahead with that state trial where, again, Dylan Roof could get the death penalty.
Could it be because of the possibility that there could be appeals to this sentence, and as well as whether or not a state execution could happen before a federal execution?
Sure. I mean, to put the issue as simply as I can, if you think Dylan Roof is someone who deserves the death penalty, if that's the sentence that you want to get, if you get two rather than one, it's more likely that if something happens to one, the other one is still in place. And, anything can happen on appeal. Anything can happen over the next 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years. And who knows what new cases are coming down from the Supreme Court. So having one in state court and having one in federal court,
raises the chances that he will get one of them instead of none.
He said, Dylann Roof admitted in his manifesto and then later in court, he wanted to start a race war. That's why he shot 9 African-American parishioners at Mother Emanuel AME. We all know that didn't work. There was no race war. In fact, there was incredible forgiveness on the part of family members of the victims. So what he did was really, well, it just seems crazy, Professor. It just seems nuts to me, and you too.
So many people have said that.
And yet he knows right from wrong. He knows, you know, that he killed the people, and at some level he shouldn't have done that, but he still did it. You got to be a little bit crazy to do something like that, do you not?
Well, you know, let's think of it this way, Bill. If you watch the nightly news every night, this is something that's happened in our quiet, good town. It's more shocking for that reason. You see the headlines every day in the main papers and on the news where some terrorist has attacked people in the street in Germany or France or recently Istanbul or somewhere else. People are being massacred by people with crazy ideologies and religious beliefs. In a way, I think that's who Dylann Roof is. He's an ideologically motivated killer, thinks the same way some of these terrorists do. And it's always more shocking when it's somebody that does it that's homegrown, that looks like the kid next door. And that's what makes it shocking. Unfortunately, it happens all too often in this world. And it's crazy to us. It's unbelievable. But these people, certain kinds of people, have their own bizarre, crazy, wingnut ideologies that lead them to look at the world in strange ways and condemn other people. And I think that's what we're dealing with.
What legal maneuvers are we going to be seeing from here? We have a verdict today, death sentence. We have a hearing tomorrow. And are we going to start all over again? Will he be moved to federal penitentiary? Will he stay here in South Carolina? What is happening next?
Well, what will happen literally next tomorrow morning is Judge Gergel has already indicated he will hear routine motions for basically a directed verdict and to set aside the sentence and new trial and that kind of thing. That's fairly routine. I don't think anybody expects him to grant any of that, but he is required by law to formally hear it and put reasons on the record if he denies it. And giving people until overnight to develop this is typical. So that's the first thing. Then he'll be committed to the Bureau of Prisons. And when he's committed to the Bureau of Prisons, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has discretion as to where to house him. And right now, over 50 of the federal death row inmates, the male inmates, are housed in Terre Haute, Indiana, in a special facility. He could stay here, but I strongly suspect that's where he's going to go. And he will stay there through his appeals in this whole process.
Let's state again, folks, in case you're just joining us, what we're talking about now. Debbie Chard and I are here with Professor Miller Shealy, and we understand Dylann Roof was just given the death penalty for killing those 9 people at Mother Emanuel AME. The jury, Debbie, was out only 2 hours and 50 minutes, a very short time for deliberating.
And we are here with Professor Miller Shealy from the Charleston School of Law. We've been talking about the proceedings today and what we can expect to come. Another motion has been filed, Dylann Roof saying that he wants new lawyers and wants to rehear the case. And that hearing is set for, that motion is set for 9:30 tomorrow morning.
You know, Dylann Roof can't have it both ways. He put up no defense whatsoever. And yet now that the verdict has come in and it's the harshest verdict he could get, he got death. He's now wanting to appeal the verdict after not doing anything in his defense. That doesn't, Professor, seem quite logical. You put up a defense, Debbie, if you want to defend yourself. When you put up no defense and you get the death penalty, then all of a sudden it's not fair?
It almost appears planned.
Well, it is planned. And he's taking probably some good advice from his lawyers. Again, why is he making these motions right now? And the simple answer is, under the law, he has to preserve his rights to appeal. He will get none if he doesn't make certain motions at the end of trial. And there are not many legal issues here. The two big ones that I see that stand out, and I'm not suggesting they're going to be successful because I don't believe they will, but one is, should he have been allowed to represent himself, which is kind of odd to raise that on appeal when you argued below that you should have been.
Right.
But he can do that, or his lawyers can. He hasn't told his lawyers that he doesn't want them to represent him on appeal. So he will have lawyers for that. He will not be able to really represent himself. The next issue is, you know, we've seen all this week and last, very interesting, These notes go into the judge. He's objecting to the victim's testimony. He's objecting to all their sadness and the tragedy and all the horrible things that have happened to him as a result of what he did. And there is something there. I don't think it will prevail, but the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has said that this kind of victim impact testimony is very appropriate. And the defense, I'm sure his lawyers are nudging him, saying it's gone too far. So that's an issue that is definitely there. Will he prevail? I doubt it, but I'm sure it will be appealed.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 14th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing from black people, victims of white supremacy, share their views on observations, what's taken place over the last 7 days, the audio segments that we heard. Certainly there were many other news items that took place over this week. If you just have counter-racist suggestions you would like to share, feel free. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. In fact, I think you can press *61, and I think that'll just fast forward everything and you won't have to do anything else. No other button pressing. It'll put your hand up. We can get you on the line. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things we will get to before we get started this week. We are listener supported, Counter Racist Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you go to the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see the PayPal button. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks, sincere thanks, tremendous appreciation for all the folks who have invested and helped keep us on the air for nearly 8 years, our anniversary next month. I hope the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy. And most importantly, I hope during that time that we have helped non-white listeners get a better understanding, an accurate understanding of what racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. Moving forward, would like to make a request. It's 2017. I feel dramatically better. I was spectacularly traumatized by 2016, which I expected, but man, it was a terrible year. I'm glad it's over. Looking forward to a dramatic improvement in 2017. In that vein, I'd like to make a request for exactly $135. What do I need $135 for? I want to get a subscription for SoundCloud, unlimited use of SoundCloud. That way I can just post all of our content on SoundCloud. I've known about this site for a number of years. I've signed up, used it. I was not going to use their site to post the Cows archives. However, a listener asked me this week, they said, why don't you have the Cows content in Google Play so that people can access the podcast there, might grow your audience, just making it more accessible. And I said, that's a good thought. I will get to work on doing that. And I could not feed the content into Google Play with our current feed. However, if I can put the content on SoundCloud, that will be taken care of. So that's the goal, to get us registered so we can have the unlimited SoundCloud account, and then I can get us on Google Play. Hopefully that will be a meager investment to increase listenership. Plus it'll give us at least two additional sites where our archives will be housed and people will have easy access to the content. So $135, I don't think that's too much to ask given 8 years of service if we're doing anything constructive. Now, we're just wasting time. Well, then, you know, you shouldn't even be listening to the program. Moving forward, other quick things I wanted to make sure I touched on before we get to the callers. For one, we will not be doing the book club this Friday within the Cows context. That's a big deal because we've only missed, unless I'm in error with my memory, we've only missed one book club in the 5 years that we've been doing this book club. We started it in May of 2012. We've only missed one time, and that was a computer problem. I didn't have my computer back in 2015, and it stalled us for 1 week. But other than that, I don't think we have missed a single book study session in 5 years. And so we're not doing it this coming Friday because President-elect Donald Trump, his inauguration going down, and the farewell to the Obamas. I am elated. This is going to be Watermelon Day on the plantation. That is a metaphor. It is going to be jubilant time. I am so excited. I cannot contain myself. I did not party when President Obama, when he was elected or reelected. I was never in that mode. I was not in tears back in November of 2008. I had the same opinion then that I have now, that white people are still in charge. Same opinion that I have now, but I am going to rejoice at their exit. I have been fussed at, attacked verbally, name-called, ridiculed because I did not vote for Obama, because I did not have hope and change paraphernalia back in 2008. And then I got fussed at sometimes by the exact same people because I would not stump up and down and throw rocks at him and call him an Uncle Tom and a Sambo and a coon. Ugh, I cannot wait for President-elect Donald Trump to get in there. I cannot wait. I cannot wait. Friday cannot come fast enough. So if people, this is another way you can invest. If you do not have $135 to invest, if there are any moments, they can be speeches, press conferences, anything involving President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, the children, Sasha and Malia, anything that happened over the last 8 years that you think is important, that is informative about racism, what it means to be white, that just stood out as significant. If it was something that you thought was funny, if it was something that made you mad, and that was a day, man, I cursed and called him every name in the book until I got my black self-respect right. That Obama really got on my nerve. Anything like that, share. I'm going to try and make a collage so we can do a whole review of the last 8 years. And I certainly have some of my favorite moments over that time period. In that vein, in fact, they even had a story in the New York Times today where they were talking about President Obama's farewell speech and his tenure in the White House on the whole. The New York Times piece, it's called "Jolted by Deaths, Obama Found His Voice on Race." You'll notice the trend from Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, not racism, race. Very important distinction. The great William Roden, author of $40 Million Slaves, he says that on his program all the time. The problem is not race. The problem is racism. He points that out all the time, how whites are real slick with not using the most accurate terms. At any rate, again, we'll be here next Friday. It'll probably be hours and hours. We'll be here for a good chunk of the day with inauguration coverage this coming Friday. Before then, on Wednesday, Pam, Trojan Horse Publications, she'll be back with us. Many of the phenomenal books that she's co-authored, Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, The Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, The Interracial Con Game. She'll be here on Wednesday. She can get in some of her thoughts on the end of the Obama era and the beginning of Trump's administration. Concluding thoughts about 2016 and other counter-racist material, but she'll be here Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. On Monday, we will have a black female. She's down in the North Carolina area, right in Mr. Scotty Reed's neck of the woods. She's being terrorized in her residence, and she thought it would be constructive, as did I, to share some of the experiences that she's had. And even importantly, whites making an effort to get her emotionally riled up, trying to provoke her, being discourteous and rude so that she responds. And then they say, oh, yep, that uncouth behavior. See, that we got, now we have justification to further abuse you. That seemed to be a strong tactic that they were using. We talked about that on workplace racism. Really, we talk about that all the time, the importance of being a professional counter-racist soldier. I don't respond to insults. I got a plan about how I'm going to be successful with my mission. That's what professional soldiers do. Before that, on Sunday, that would be tomorrow, in a matter of hours, we'll be here for the Sunday Global Talk on Racism. We'll have non-white people from across the globe. They'll be here to share their views on the system of white supremacy, what they've seen in the early stages of 2017. In fact, there was a prison riot in Birmingham right at the end of December, and some of our listeners in the UK wanted to touch on that as well. But that'll be tomorrow. Early broadcast, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. That's the Sunday Global Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. With that, we'll go ahead and get to callers. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Remind folks, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that way we'll make sure we get everyone who calls in who has commentary to share. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that way we don't have a lot of interference and background noise distorting the broadcast. Really appreciate that. Thank you kindly. And again, for the compensatory call-in, no metaphors. That was something I will try to prompt about, but it's been my experience that racists, they do a phenomenal job. They do this deliberately on a regular basis. They will use metaphors, analogies, make comparisons between things that are not equivalent, not even close, and they will do this to spread confusion. This impacts a lot of victims of white supremacy, impacts our thinking. We end up picking up that habit, and sometimes just we don't have our thoughts completely formulated. We're still thinking. We're still learning. So sometimes we will use a metaphor or an analogy to help us articulate our thoughts, and it does not minimize confusion. In fact, it greatly, in my view, increases confusion. Again, a lot of times we're comparing things that are not equivalent, and sometimes we're just using jargon and phrases that don't really spell out explicitly in detail what it is that you're saying or what your view is. That happens a lot. If we could just be direct, explicit about what we're saying, no metaphors, just for this broadcast. Thank you kindly. With that, we will go ahead and get started. The first few folks who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So, just based on the previous audio, I actually find it pretty interesting how my generation uses social media. I mean, we arrange it to many different ways. We use it in many different ways, for example, to display beautiful parts of the world, just to give, like, promotions about a different company or business, just to have fun. But then it can get ugly. Like in the previous audios, just based on one of the Catholic high schools, a white person were to target a black senior of the high school, calling him so many derogatory terms, and that it's just interesting to me because, like I said before, I feel like the white people are getting pretty scared of targeting black people just based on the fact that they're targeting them behind an incognito username and a phone screen. Because just like if they weren't scared, they would confront them face to face. Just get it on and going. Just basically like that. And it's just, I feel like they don't know what the black person is going to do to them. They don't know what they're capable of, so they would rather go behind an electronic screen and say what they got to say there, to make fun of them, mistreat them, discriminate them, target them, just do whatever they got to do to make sure they get their point. And I also find it unnecessary to say that type of things on social media, because if you were to vent like that, I would say that to the person face to face rather than on the internet where everyone can see it. That's just me, but I don't know. And it's just very interesting how that works. Just me being a high school student, I know how that works, and it's just funny to me just how everything changes year after year. And like I said last week too, white people are becoming more bold with what they say. They're not just indirectly saying it. They will post something, say the person's name, who they're targeting, and go bananas on them. It's actually pretty funny how that works. And it's just, I mean, I expect it, of course, but wow, like, it's very interesting and weird how life works now, and how we can't even, because that's just like, it's basically like in a code book. It says no, you're not supposed to be squabbling with one another or gossiping with one another, and that really changed the behavior of high school students, especially at the Catholic school, because you're really not supposed to be doing that there. So it really just changes a person's attitude and what they're representing. And yeah, that's all I wanted to share tonight. Thank you for taking my call.
May I be heard?
Our young scholar of the Bay. Yes, sir. I just wanted to let folks, that's our young scholar in the Bay Area, regular caller. Always great to hear his input. The religion of white supremacy, and many folks have come to the same conclusion as our young scholar here, that it seems that race soldiers, whites are just being more explicit, more open. And it seems like there are a lot of news clips that might bear that out. Caller that was just going to speak up. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program today. I am still learning. I have concluded that white people lie to black people in all areas of people activity. White people are serious about being serious about practicing racism, white supremacy. Black people have to practice self-respect and self-respect with each other. Black people have to stay focused on a code of thought, speech, and action, and emotional response over and over and over again. I had to take some time away from this very necessary form and program that Gus has provided to us in order to pause from the pain of losing Dr. Francis Quest Welsing and to give myself some relief from thinking about how bad racism, white supremacy was for me in 2006. Regarding the audio segments, Christine Davis, I guess that's the white actress who adopted a black child. I believe white people who adopt black children is for insidious reasons. White people adopt black children as pets, like dogs and cats. Mark Wahlberg, the actor, he practices racism, white supremacy in the past and in the future. A racist only refines their practices of racism, white supremacy. Regarding Dylann Roof's conviction, I encourage black people to wait to see the final outcome of this case and wait to see what racism, white supremacy would do with this case. Regarding a race war, it's already been started prior to Dylann Roof, so that narrative about Dylann Roof wanting to start a race war, that has been in place prior to Dylann Roof. Gus, in terms of your request for $135, I'm going to commit to sending you $200. Now, I don't know if you want me to give the address where I sent before was a post office box in 73324 is that still a good post office box?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm committed to sending you $200. I'll send that out tomorrow. I have to go get a money order. Also, can I do the prayer this evening?
Oh, for sure. Just remind me. I'm a victim, so I might forget. Just, you know, give me a heads up if I forget.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Outstanding. Appreciate it. Yes, sir. Robin, Wisconsin. Feel free.
Greetings to Gus, the rest of the callers on the line. Thank you to the last caller for making that commitment. I think that us supporting other black people is a good thing. start by saying I just got news that I will be bringing another black life into the world. So I'm I feel good in a sense. I feel just a little more comfort on the ship just in having that news. And start by saying black hair. I have dreadlocks, and I encountered my uncle one day, and he said, "What's wrong with your hair?" I'm like, "What you mean? What's wrong with my hair?" He said, "It usually look good." I said, "It do look good." "Nah, man, you know, you usually have it laid out." Another interaction with my mom. I had just got my dreadlocks French braided, and as soon as I walked through the door, "Now that look good." I said, "What you mean? Your hair, that looks good." And my response was that my hair always looks good, and you know. And even in speaking that, I'm still processing that interaction with my mom about my hair. in Milwaukee, I know it made national news about the shooting of Seville Smith. So with the... After the shooting took place, funds were allocated to a certain area to go for, to be used for housing, to rehab houses in that area where some fires had took place. So they were advertising the houses being sold for a dollar. In actuality, you need a quarter of $1 million to qualify for the quote-unquote dollar house. So there has been a lot of people in the community not happy with how the funds are being used. I'll mute my line for right now. Thanks for listening.
Congratulations. That is spectacular. You being able to having another offspring. Spectacular. Might even be someone, I think, Estat was just when we did the program, surprise program earlier this week where I attended the baby shower, and Estat called in and he said he was looking to correlate information because he was a doula. Generally, that's not something that males do, but he said since, you know, he's married and he wanted to take care of his offspring, his wife, so he wanted to kind of collate the notes from his experience. So might be someone else who could use that information. And I know we did have listeners as well who also contacted and said they would like that information. So Estat, if you're listening, I will drop you a message. You do have folks who are interested, maybe someone in Wisconsin now who might be interested. Other folks who, and the confusion with the money, that's standard. operating procedure. Anytime there's some sort of disturbance like that, and, oh, we're going to get funds so we can rebuild L.A. after all of this, and it's been over 20 years since the rioting in L.A. It's been over 50 years since the rioting in after Dr. King was assassinated, and nothing. They can, you know, have people squabble about the money and forget you. Are other folks we haven't heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Yeah, this is Ken Steele reporting from Los Angeles tonight. And I just wanted to say that, yeah, that broadcast that you aired with the audio with Kristen Davis, I believe, extremely disturbing audio. I think that more victims of racism should listen to audio segments like that while put in the proper context to understand that these people are in the process of harming black people. I think an interesting exchange that went on in that interaction was when Kristen was being very unclear with her words. However, the person that was interviewing her was agreeing along, nodding along, and claiming to understand what was being articulated, even though what was being said was didn't make any sense. I think that victims of racism should make a point of asking suspected white supremacists for more clarification when they speak, and should pay very, very close attention when racist suspects are speaking, so that you can ask for clarification when it is needed. Also, I wasn't able to contribute to workplace racism this week. Would it be all right if I shared some information that I came across that I think would be pertinent to the listeners?
Sure.
Awesome. There was a report earlier this week that implicated Facebook's recruiting staff, or rather they quoted Facebook's recruiting staff that their efforts for hiring quote-unquote diversity candidates, I'm suspecting that means non-white candidates, or rather in this instance, non-white and non-Asian candidates, were operated against by hiring managers at Facebook. And this is something that is going on not only at Facebook, but I can report that it's going on at multiple tech firms. I've personally overseen processes whereby hiring managers at tech firms will deliberately wait for recruiters to send candidates that are white, or they will find fault with candidates that are non-white that don't make any sense pertaining to what the outlined criteria for the job is. I've even had hiring managers, well, rather, one thing that I'm seeing consistently being said amongst hiring managers in this sector is you will send a candidate who is, I guess, classified as white, and when you hear the responses, they'll say things like, oh, this is a solid guy, or this is a stand-up gentleman. I've heard that phrase being used multiple times. And oftentimes, the people that are being presented are not nearly as qualified as the non-white candidates that were presented previously. And they will say that these candidates aren't able to talk through their problems or aren't able to show their work, and they'll have a whole litany of reasonable sounding critiques for these candidates. So I don't want victims of racism to be discouraged when going for opportunities in that sector. I think that we need more people that know the technologies that are shaping the tools that we use to communicate on a fundamental level. But be advised that, yeah, there is a concerted effort to keep us out of these positions, and it's I'm just confronting that on a personal and direct level and seeing that firsthand. I know it's something that I should be aware of and I should be prepared for, but it's heartbreaking. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's seriously some of the toughest conversations that I've had in recent memory were behind this problem, this very problem. So that's what I wanted to put out there. And also, I just want to say, lastly, we need something. We need some sort of platform where we're coordinating our efforts in a more substantive way than I see that's going on. Because I see suspected racists using forums like Reddit to coordinate entire political campaigns undercover, and they're operating against us at a very high level. And I think that we need to be mindful that we need to take compensatory action and form compensatory apparatuses to address this. Thank you so much.
For sure. Appreciate that information as well. Other folks who we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
May I be?
Oh, wait. We'll nab the female. We generally will get the female caller first.
Okay, all right. This is Karma. Hello. Hello, everyone, for 2017.
Karma.
I'm looking forward to 2017. Like you guys, that was really horrendous. On that dirty dog roof, I've been thinking, he probably, with everything that the imaginations of the white people, he thought that President Obama was probably going to be president for life. So he was going to go out as a martyr. But then maybe when Donald Trump became president, he goes, oh, I can probably get a pardon, or I can have my conviction overturned on appeal, but it will probably have to be a pardon. And I mean, it doesn't even matter if it's Trump or Pence, either one I'm sure would do it. And like I did remind you guys later, the young children are coming home from school and they're saying that all the white children are telling them that black people are going to, Donald Trump's going to, you know, be assassinated and black people are going to do it. That just means the FBI probably already has it planned, and they're going to try and blame it, of course, on black people. But I think that's what happened to Roof. I think that he changed his mind when Donald Trump became president and said, you know, I can get a pardon. So, I did listen to him when he was giving his confession, that portion of his confession, and I thought it was interesting. You know, he said, well, you know, I chose the church people because, and I wish I could remember it verbatim, but it's like because I figured they would be more docile. I had thought about, you know, killing a drug dealer, but I thought they might shoot me back. So, you know, his conception of black people goes from either you're a churchgoer or you're a drug dealer. That's it. Those are your two choices. And I'm thinking that may be it with the wider white world. We're either all drug dealers of some kind or we're churchgoers, and there's nothing in between. Let's see, what else is it? Oh, I have some good news, I think. I have some good news. You remember white people, and he was saying, oh, I want to start a race war. Of course, we're already at war. What he's thirsting for is more direct violence against us. They just crave that. Like, I guess that's that Neanderthal genealogy. But good news. All right, here we live in a very rural area, and the white people, you know, they work against us with deceptions, either deception or direct violence. So they came and they said, we're going to make the gutters in front of your property deeper. So, you know, when the rains come to Texas this time, everyone won't get washed away. And it was just it was a bloody, muddy mess. And I mean, it looked like somebody just scarred the earth, and it was just terrible looking. The landscape had been destroyed. And, you know, they went on about their business, leaving this ugly, gaping, whatever, mile-long trench in front of our properties. So we said, well, we can't deal with that. We'll have to go to the store and get seed. We'll have to reseed all of this area so grass will grow. And this white guy, who obviously, you know, didn't get too far along in school, he looks at us, you know, he goes, we told him what we wanted the seed for, and he goes, well, you know, they're supposed to come back and reseed that. And I'm like, you're kidding me. I've got $100 worth of seed here. And white people have just gone on about their business, and they know that they all know these things. They know I'm 50-something years old. I've seen them do this before. Nobody ever came back to my property to reseed it. They always left it a gaping mess. And I think every white person probably knows that they have money in the budget to do this. But they take that money, and they either keep the seed for themselves, or they just give themselves a bonus at the end of the year, and they never reseed any of the black people's property after they destroy it. And so, I mean, I called the Texas Department of Roads and Bridges, and they said, oh, okay, well, we'll be right out. White people know these things, and they keep them from us. I mean, that's just so sad. But I wanted to tell everybody about that in case you have that problem. I want to tell you about one more thing. It's kind of anti-black, but do I have time? I'll tell you something.
Can you do it in 60 seconds? Is it a 60-second thing, or do you need more time?
Okay, I will. Okay, I saw showcasing. We had to dissolve our child welfare board here because they were stealing all the money from the little black and Hispanic kids. So we had to dissolve it, and they got this one black woman. She shows up out of the blue. They appoint her to the new child welfare board, and the first thing she does is read this letter and says, well, you know what? We just want to move forward, and we don't want to cause any enemies, and we're not looking to cause any problems and hold anybody accountable. And the white people in court stood up and clapped, because here is another black person saying, doesn't matter that you stole all of this money from these little homeless black kids in CPS and the Child Welfare Board. Here's a black person saying, we're giving you a pass. And I just said, oh, my goodness. They always go and find the right one to do that every single time, so they are never held accountable for their criminal acts. There. I'm done. Thanks.
Easily done in 60 seconds. And I think as easily as that was done, racists, they have an even easier time selecting victims of racism that they can showcase as needed to, you know, here's the script, just say this, nigger. Very, very easy. That they have lots of practice at doing that. Other victims that we have not heard from, other callers, feel free.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? Yes, sir.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. This is Lane from Kansas City. I don't know if this was already brought up in the broadcast. I started about 30 minutes and I was able to get on the call. I believe it was recently the circus, Barnum and Bailey Circus, has announced that they will be closing their operations in some form or some way, shape, or form, shutting down the circus as we know it after 140-something years running. For victims of racism, I think that's of note, and how the system of racism, white supremacy is always refining, because the circus as we know it, and a strong argument can be made, is that was created by the freak show. And in many circuses across the U.S., not just Barnum and Bailey, black people were used, specifically black people and other non-white peoples were either taken from other countries, zoos, some were used, and the Muse Brothers, I believe, is one that comes to mind. There were albino black twins who were stolen from their family in the early 1900s. So I think it's of note that the circus is saying that they want to shut down operations. Of recently, in the past 20 or so years, the big commotion has been about the animals, but for many victims, including myself. I was unaware of the history of the circus and how it was essentially built on the back, as many other institutions, forgive the metaphor. It was built on non-white and a lot of black men and women. I did take note also of Kristen Davis, the actress. Sadly, when I was 13 or so, I began watching that program, Sex and the City. Very psychologically damaging for a non-white black male to be watching that program. I think I was 13 or 14, and I watched it for two or so years. Extremely damaging to my psychological makeup, specifically growing up in a majority white part of the world, city and town. I do believe that that was a great example of how white people can continue to adopt black, non-white and black children and continually practice racism and abuse these young children, having them. How could she not think about how to fight for racism when she was so heartbroken over seeing what her her adopted offspring had to go through? Again, it's almost like my pet. I care about my pet, and everyone else can suffer. That was of note to me. Again, I don't believe they're ignorant, and they continue this. It's very popular in this part. In the city I live in, these white people who adopt black children. Tying into that, I do want to say, don't want to up the previous caller, but I recently found out yesterday that I will be bringing another black boy or girl, possibly twins again, into this world. Yesterday, I found out in the morning. I was extremely elated that I will be bringing in, hopefully, one or more children that could help end this system by their efforts. I remember at one time I used to be of the mindset that I didn't want to bring children in the world at all because of how the world is, how the world is so bad. But in reality, I believe that that type of thinking serves the white supremacists and their system because they're a very small minority. And we have to, as Dr. Cambon, overpower them, but in a sense, not just by numbers, but by the type of children we raise and the communities we make. So I'm very happy. I have twins now, and I will probably be bringing, there's a good chance I could bring in two more children into this world, but I will be having more children here. So I did listen to the program on Monday, the archive. I listened to it yesterday. Just happened to hear it in the evening. I'm actually on the board of a black birthing and doula nonprofit in Kansas City, and I really would like to communicate or get some information from the Brother Estot, because I believe that it'd be extremely constructive for non-white men, specifically black males, to give their input on helping and birthing. Simply put, because the white dominators are not helping us. They're extremely obstructive when it comes to birthing, black birthing. And we went through a very traumatic experience dealing with the dominators, almost me being kicked out of a hospital because of my stalwartness against their overt racism while our children were being born previously. But we will not have that because we're having a home birth. We're planning to make a home birth if the dominators don't have anything to say about it. So I will, again, congratulate the other caller, and thank everyone for listening.
Congratulations again. That's outstanding. More attempted black parents and more non-white people, more black people on the way who can help to solve this problem that is outstanding, particularly folks pursuing home birth options, natural birth options. That is brilliant, brilliant. Keep those racists' paws off your children. Folks, we have not heard from at all. Anybody, we have not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard?
Will Nabraz.
All right. Greetings to you guys and to the other callers and the listeners. I also wanted to congratulate Rob from Milwaukee and Ken Steele as well on the upcoming births of your children. I wish you all the best, and it's great to know that you've both, through your upcoming births, allowed an ancestor to return. So it's going to be a beautiful thing, and I wish you a safe delivery. I wanted to touch on some of the clips the clip you played on the violin, I found that to be interesting. One thing I studied and learned about is how playing an instrument can facilitate the mental capacity of children, especially non-white children. My son played the trumpet starting in about the third or fourth grade, and he still plays it to this day. And he's even talked about just his playing the instrument and how it helped him. And he also makes music as well, but just how it helped him in just his thought patterns, the way he learned and facilitated a lot of his growth, his mental growth as far as his academics were concerned. So I found that to be really good. Weirdly enough, I'm personal friends with a jazz artist. Her name is Janice Grice Reedus. She was married to a jazz drummer named Tony Reedus, who passed away back in 2008. And he's a famous drummer. And she plays the violin. She plays in the Newark area. So you can actually look her up, and she's really talented. So I just wanted to toss that out there, too. The clip you played with Kristen Davis, the white female adoptive abductor, I just thought that whole segment was interesting and just speaks volumes to why white people should not be able to adopt non-white children at all. I found it very interesting when she was discussing her so-called adopted daughter's experience, where she felt less than for not being white, and she actually spoke of herself, of course, becoming the victim. She said she also felt less than growing up, looking at magazines and things like that. But when you're looking in, there's no comparison when you're a white female looking in a magazine full of white females to literally being a non-white person who is looked at as the complete opposite of everything you're looking at in any magazine or on the television. So she was just practicing racism even in that interview, and it was a little nauseating to listen to. And weirdly enough, recently I had a coworker who brought her child to work, and she's in a tragic arrangement with a black male from Africa. And the child was just a beautiful young black male child. He looks like his father, so he's actually a handsome child. And I just felt so sorry for that child. I looked at him and I said, "Wow, I hope your father gets a serious understanding of the system of white supremacy and really gives you what you need, because this is the same white female who I talked about earlier, who talked about herself not being racist, but understanding that there was parts of Brooklyn she didn't want to walk around with her husband, knowing that she could potentially be in physical harm's way, as well as him, just for them being together in certain areas." And she's just another refined white supremacist, and I feel sorry for that child, and I feel sorry for her husband, because he really doesn't understand what he's dealing with coming from another country. Mark Wahlberg, he's just an arch racist who plays games, and I find him to be an interesting propagandist. I found it telling at the end of the interview, he said that he was a proud Bostonian and he was proud to be a part of this story. Now, this story is the story of him practicing racism against Vietnamese people. So he's proud to be in this. Like, I'm just thinking of the psychology of that and how much of a proverbial Freudian slip that was, that he was able to say. And it was very brief at the very end of the interview. He said he's proud to be a Bostonian and he's proud to be a part of this story. So you're proud to practice racism, white supremacy is what he's saying. And lastly, I just wanted to just give a shout out to the caller that's doing the prayer tonight. I was actually thinking about you quite a bit throughout the year 2016. I was worried about you. I like to hear your insightful commentary, and I'm glad to see that you're back. I hope that you're healing. I wish you the best, and hope hopefully we'll be able to hear more from you this year. Thank you, Gus, and I'll meet my line.
Thank you.
Thank you, too, brother. I wish you the best.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Greetings, everyone. Well, what was very interesting was the article that you put on Facebook about that William Roden wrote. His articles are always interesting within the people activity of entertainment / sports, where he was speaking about the many different professions that are centered around sports, that rarely occupied by non-white black people. And it can be a very interesting article for someone who did not know, because there's so many other professions other than just the quote-unquote gladiator that's on the court, the basketball court or the football field, running around. There's so many other professions that are involved in that atmosphere. Also, I have been enlightening other non-white victims on your article about the fallacy of thinking that white people are ignorant to racism, white supremacy. And I kind of like give some insight that this was written by a relatively young person, and is very clear and razor sharp on his logic about what a lot too many non-white black people don't have a full understanding of, in thinking that white people practice racism because they're ignorant or they're just ignorant to it, and there's nothing further from the truth. And your article aids me in the process of sharing with other non-white people. So I just thought I'd mention that, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to the callers. Hope everybody's doing well. A couple of observations. In reference to Mr. Roof, and I know Gus might have already done this, but I just recommend people read his manifesto. Based upon all the guests that Gus has had over the years and Dr. Welsing, his manifesto literally touches on every single trait of white supremacy, from raping and taking over and everything that Dr. Welsing has talked about in reference to genetic annihilation. I just think it's mandatory reading to understand the whole system and how specifically they think. Another observation, I came in late, so I didn't have a chance to listen to all the clips, but there was a commercial in the area of entertainment for an interview with Charlie Sheen and Michael Strahan, and they were giggling and laughing and joking, and I just found that to be, it was just typical tackiness, because based upon some of the allegations of Mr. Sheen being knowingly infected with HIV and passing it on, suspected to other women without them knowing, or engaging in other non-constructive behavior, I just wonder if they would be laughing if that was a white female that was interviewing him. I could be wrong, but I think they used Mr. Strahan specifically to showcase that. Over the next 3 or 4 months, we're going to see a lot of smart, intelligent, and wonderful black males with March Madness. It's very sad, even though I'm a basketball fan, but when I see all these millions of kids, specifically black males, that dominate most athletics, but particularly in the area of basketball, all these young men, and sometimes I just wonder if some of these kids, or if we've had other ways for them to be more constructive, as opposed to playing basketball games. Another thing is that particularly in my area of Virginia, listening to the cows has really helped me in just understanding when I was less confused. I have a thing about, I like to do tours of plantations. I don't know why. I find them very interesting. I like to ask a lot of questions. But what I've noticed is that there's one in Louisa, Virginia. It's called Prospect Hill, and they actually have on their website, and you can Google it, to where you can get the experience. And I don't believe that you can tour this plantation, but one thing I would like to start to do when I go back to some of these tours, because I've done Monticello and Montpelier, if I'm pronouncing them correctly. I've done those a couple times, but I didn't ask adequate questions. But what I want to do, again, when the weather gets a little better, is just start to ask better questions about why is white terrorism being showcased
And were these slaves running away an adequate response to terrorism? And I'm just starting to ask more questions, and I appreciate the show, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Was rape practiced on this plantation?
Absolutely.
That might be a or that might be a mandatory question to ask anytime you go to any of these reenactments of the glory days in the antebellum South. Any other folks, anybody we have not heard from at all? Anybody at all that we have not heard from?
Please, can I be heard?
Any call? Yes, ma'am.
Chief Gus and all the other listeners, I just wanted to share something. We are seeking a larger shelter, so we've been visiting different companies and properties and things like that. Well, I encountered a racist person during this, in search of a place or whatever. And she basically was being very unprofessional and started talking about the election and how she voted for Trump. And she even went on to mention how this is one thing I guess you can put in the little clips you're doing, Gus, about the Obama thing. She said that when Obama became president, she thought that he was going to make all white people slaves. And I was just sitting there, like, basically the responses I was giving her was like, oh, really? Oh, really? Like, she kept going on and on. So by me saying, oh, really, I guess that continued the conversation. So she even said the typical her black friends and how she really can't believe this election with Trump is making everything a black and white. It was just typical racist jargon. So I just wanted to mention that. And, of course, we're not going to rent from there.
Wow.
So I looked at that place. Yeah, I just was basically, like, just sucking it all in, you know what I mean? But I was like, oh, no, like, this is definite a no. But, yeah, it was very unprofessional.
Brilliant. Brilliant. That would have been all kinds of problems having to deal with her on a regular basis. And that even sounded like a modified version with Mr. Fuller when he has in the code book where he says, oh, really? There you go, this modified version. That you can leave it at that. Nothing else need be said. And apparently it was comfortable enough for her to keep talking. That can work to your advantage, too, because he's, oh, yeah, you are confirming that, yes, you're a race soldier, so I need to adjust my behavior accordingly. Thank you for talking, white person, racist. Let's see. Always Grant here from B-More. Anybody that we missed completely? Anybody else have commentary?
May I be heard?
Heard both of you. We'll get Greg second. The female caller.
Okay. Greetings, everybody. Before I begin, congratulations to the new babies that are coming. That's awesome. That's really, really exciting. So congratulations. I'm going to use – oh, really? It made me giggle every time y'all were saying it. So I think I'm going to try that as part of my notification. And a couple of notes on some of the things that I heard. For the removal of the nurses from Jamaica, speaking for myself, I know that although there's like a subtle push to go into healthcare, when you get in the classroom, that encouragement, that support in terms of acquiring the necessary math skills and science skills and all that stuff was not necessarily there. So it's really disheartening. You know, everyone can say, oh, become a doctor, and oh, become this, or become a nurse even. And, you know, but it's different in there. And so what I thought about when I heard this is, you know, although the face of racism has changed, it's, deprive the world of all kinds of access to resources, and then you can go around the world taking whatever you want, whether it's specs, whether it's resources from the ground, or it's intelligence to invent new things, or it's doctors and medical healthcare workers. And when you're around the world and you want more and you have family you have to take care of, it's very hard to say no to being able to triple your salary for doing practically the same work. And although I don't think the author of this article intended it this way, but the whole world is the white man's brothel. I mean, I don't know if that's a metaphor. It might be. I'm not sure. Anyway, just if you deprive the whole world of being able to do for self, then you can always go and get whatever you want for way less, for cheaper, pretty much. And when it comes to the bank robber clip, when I heard it, what came to mind is this is what it means to be white. I've heard many situations where white people will say they were able to steal, like literally go into stores and just steal stuff, and they knew no one was looking at them because they're white. This is exactly what it means to be white. That's why I don't entertain any conversations where people are talking about, oh, they're white and poor or whatever. You go to the thrift store and get yourself a nice suit. You speak articulately. You can get a job, period. You're white. Like, you can just start crying as a female and get your refund and a gift card because you're white. It, you can do anything and do no wrong because you're white. And, you know, you could be a robber and be glorified because you use the proper semicolon, because you're white. And then, you know, but then it also means that to be black means that I am the parasite that's like, that made the whole world terrible and I should just figure out where to go. So moving on, for the trans racial adoption, number one, white female crying, whatever. And I giggled because she didn't even really cry. I was like, number one, I'm dealing with an actor. Number two, is like she's if you're really crying, you don't just stop crying mid cry. I mean, what? Anyway, and then assuming that white people who adopt black babies are for racial justice, I think we do this also with white people who engage in sexual activity with non-white people, or just. You know, it just, okay, well, now you're involved, so you have to be for so-called racial justice. And then she avoided many of the questions. I was like, this actress, politician, white witch. And he's like, man, answer a question, please. And then the way that I'm sorry, like I'm over white people thinking that I'm sorry is supposed to make everything better. No. And then with the question with, well, what are you doing or how do you plan to help your daughter see herself as beautiful or what? I don't remember the specific question, but she said, I tell her because I have to tell her. That having to tell someone something is not the same as telling them something because it's true, because you believe it to be true and you want that to come through. She had no constructive actual suggestions whatsoever. And listening to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I was looking at the hate that produced hate. This is the reason it's racist, and, you know, it's so subtle. It's racist to be white and adopt non-white, specifically black children, because it's like you cherry-pick one or you select one, and you think that you're going to do something good by enabling this black person to view you and other white people as not racist instead of allowing the family, mother, father, whomever, of that black child to be sufficient and take care of that black child. So giving them the money. And I used to feel that way about Angelina Jolie as well. Instead of taking the baby, why give all the money that you're going to spend on this baby, whatever, to the family, allow that family to take care of that child. And that is another way, that's why I consider it racist. Finally, to wrap up, when I was listening to the Roof piece, what I heard was, he, and this is a metaphor, but I have no other way to say it, he wants to be like Mumia. I don't know if he knows about Mumia or his like intention. He's like, I don't care if I'm on death row. I'm pretty much a martyr. All these white people are going to look at me. I'll be able to sit here, and, hey, I will write many manifestos and articles and as whatever, and I will be famous and be interviewed on ID and whatever else, and I'll die much later. Look, whatever. And I can sit here and do this from the comfort of a cell. With that, thank you.
Greg in Missouri, you were going to chime in, sir?
Yeah, what's going on to all the callers? And Gus, I just wanted to touch on a few points with the clips. The young student artist that did the painting represent Ferguson and St. Louis with the police, I think that's a very tacky gesture for the white, I forget his name, but the suspected white supremacist to you know, request to have that taken down. They take it down, then they put it back up, and then they take it back down. I actually know the young man's brothers, actually, but I don't know him personally or haven't spoken with him. But I found that to be very tacky. With Dylan Roof, I you know, a few months ago when you was talking about the case and the video, I found it interesting that Dylan Roof in his FBI interrogation, you know, he referred to himself as not being a so-called a white supremacist, that he was, you know, this white nationalist. And then you had the alt-right Richard Spencer, you know, saying that he wasn't a white supremacist, that he's, you know, this white nationalist. You know, so I just thought about, you know, these white supremacists, you know, not wanting to be classified white supremacists, but they are white supremacists. You know, Dylan Roof with this manifesto, you know, him being in the courtroom, you know, being very terroristic, but yet he doesn't, you know, he doesn't classify himself or want to be, you know, this white supremacist person. So that was interesting. I'm not sure if anybody has seen the Donald Trump challenge, where, you know, I've seen like students, you know, talking, and then someone comes in, Donald Trump's coming, and then everyone kind of scatters, or they fall to the ground and act like they're dead. That was interesting to me. Also today, I was going to the store, a white woman, as I was coming out, I saw the white woman. I didn't acknowledge her, and she was asking me, and she said, excuse me, but I didn't turn around and look at her. I knew she was going to ask me for some type of money to give her, which I was not going to do that. Also, I just want to chime in on a conversation I had with my mother. My sister has a so-called white friend that is close with her son. Her white son is close to my nephew. He's been knowing him for years. She told me that she, like during Thanksgiving, she called the lady, the white woman, and was asking, you know, if they could come and get her to come over for Thanksgiving, because they're really, you know, really close. She's really close to this suspected white supremacist. And my mother told me that her husband was in the background, and he was like, oh, she's mad because we voted for Donald Trump. And, you know, that was that. So I was like, wow. And this is a white suspected white supremacist that I've met before. And, you know, I don't know why my sister, you know, is really close with this white woman. And I just, that was just a clear sign that, you know, she definitely needs to leave these people alone and, you know, get more codified with how she deals with suspected white supremacists. Also, I want to chime in with the Ben Carson. I think Ben Carson, you know, will be used as someone Donald Trump will use to kind of reform this whole healthcare, but he has him in a position under the HUD as kind of like a, you know, we're just going to put the Negro right here, but I'm going to use him for this healthcare, really, because that's where his expertise is. But I'm going to give him this position and use him for HUD and kind of have him deal with, you know, black issues on that end. So I think he will be used for two positions, and, you know, I think that's tacky, trashy by the white supremacist Donald Trump. And I hope Ben Carson, you know, knows that he may be getting played, you know, being affiliated with that. That's all I had.
Real quick, does your sister, does she allow her child to go to these white people's house?
Oh yes. Yeah, they, you know, I met the white woman and her family this past summer for like an eighth grade graduation. But yeah, he's been knowing her son, you know, since like third grade, and her son is his best friend, according to what he told me. So they, you know, they let him, you know, he's been over their homes and, you know, he's definitely friends. And so over the time, she's built a relationship with this woman. So she's very close. And yeah, it's, it's a weird relationship to me that she has with this white woman.
Hmm. Man, that's one of the few times where I appreciate not having children, because, man, that is particularly if you don't have accurate information about racism and you have children and you don't get that information until later, like, oh, man, it's so difficult. But, I mean, that's the sort of thing that you need to be thinking about in advance, like having a code. Even though I don't have children, I know one thing would be a part of my parenting code is that our children cannot be in some white person's house. Like, that, I mean, this could be Dylan Roof's house. This could be Jeffrey Dahmer's house. Like, that just, no. I mean, they might be in a situation, school, playground, that sort of thing, where, you know, they might have to be able to function as we do around a white person, a white child, whatever the case may be, where they can do that. But in an actual white person's residence, man, that, at least for me, absolutely not. And we would be working on that code from conception, before conception, actually. Man, I hope, hopefully, your sister, she will be receptive and ready to listen some point soon, given what happened with the Trump making, or her, I guess, her white friend's husband making his thoughts known. Hopefully that will help her be more curious, and you can be there to, bang, give correct information and help out. Let's see. Anyone that we have missed? Is anybody that we have not heard from at all?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had a few observations of some articles that I've come across here locally. And there was a professor at the University of Florida that was doing an interview with a local news person about, I guess, starting a petition to get the, I think, like some lynching victims from back in history of black people listed like downtown at the city hall or in front of the old original courthouse. And what I found to be interesting was that they were conducting the interview in front of this Confederate statue of I think they call it Old Joe. And I guess, you know, they had that controversy, you know, speaking of Dylan Roof, he had that flag. I think that's what pretty much started up a lot of the Confederate flag discussion. And I kept using, I kept hearing that term, heritage, not hate, and people, you know, well, some white people accepting that part of the past, but when it comes to slavery and how black people have been mistreated, brutalized, they like to pretty much mitigate that significance of what happened to us. So it's a white professor, actually. He's trying to, I guess, get some kind of memorial downtown where they will have a listing of the lynching victims that were lynched in front of the courthouse. You know, actually, that's pretty much where I work at. So my grandmother had told me that they was doing this years ago, but I didn't really have no kind of significant clarity on it. So that was the first article I read. And the second, since it's coming up on the MLK Jr. holiday, like there was a, like they did like a vigil walk from the campus, the UF campus to downtown. And the article said that before they did it, they were met with a noose that was on some kind of, I guess, some kind of a auditorium hall on the campus. So they didn't reveal this person's name, but they said the person who sat the noose on the auditorium hall was from some kind of theater group, I guess people who do some kind of acting or some kind of drama plays or whatever. And they said, well, you know, he didn't do it because of hate. That's the term they was using. He didn't do it because of hate. It was because he was trying to use some kind of symbolism to reflect how his semester was starting now. The semester has started a little while ago, but, you know, I know I've heard, I believe Gus and many people say, you know, when it comes to coincidence, it's not really coincidence. It's you, obviously you got this holiday coming up and they're about to do this walk, you know, so you're going to see this news. You're going to show the news to the college students that's about to do the walk. And they didn't even reveal this person's face or give his name. And the president of University of Florida was pretty much defending this person. You know, I'm assuming he knew who he was too. And they just showed a picture of a police officer holding the noose. And, you know, that's pretty much the story they told. And I even seen some white people on the Facebook page for the news station, they didn't even believe that, because I'm thinking, like was usually said, that they're not ignorant. So even though that's what one of the anchors said, hey, you know, we don't know if it was ignorance or whether it was hate. So, yeah, they still use that that slogan pretty much. And that's all I have to share for now. Thank you.
Fascinating. I checked while you were sharing. There's an article online. This is at WUFT.org. This was posted on January 12th, Thursday. Rope tied into noose as joke, University of Florida student says. So I'm scrolling down just to get to the update. So one of the more recent updates. At the University of Florida organization, Theater Strike Force held auditions in Weimer Hall's Gannett Auditorium. A person tied a rope in the room to resemble a noose, wait for it, as a joke. One student there for the auditions told WUFT News, us being dumb college students doing comedy, after auditions ended, we noticed the rope the student Michael Springthorpe wrote in a text message. So one person, as a joke, tied it in a real bad noose, like it had only three or four loops. I wasn't involved, but I saw it go down, he added. Those there didn't untie it when they left, Springthorpe said. The rope wasn't brought into the room by the organization, but was there throughout auditions on Tuesday and Wednesday, he said. Theater Strike Force said it will be releasing a statement soon on the incident. A joke, and they're dumb. Always. Other folks we have not heard from at all.
Hello? Hello,
yes,
may
sir.
I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks again, Gus, for putting this program together. It was through your program I got to hear from people such as Dr. Kamau Kamban and hearing his perspective on, you know, the greatest problem that ever touched the planet Earth, and also hearing Dr. Wellesley speak on your program, as well as Neely Fuller. That's been really great to hear. But to kind of touch on some points, some things that I've observed over the week, you know, I think recently it was Donald Trump who had Steve Harvey come over to the Trump Tower, and a lot of people were kind of, you know, getting upset about this, up in arms about, you know, Steve Harvey and many other black, quote-unquote, stars that pretty much have nothing to do with politics or policy, by the way, but they're visiting Donald Trump. And what does this mean? Are they cooning? Are they for real? Do they really think that Trump can actually do something positive or constructive for black people?
Yeah, I said zero tolerance policy on name calling, and I said explicitly any derivative of coon that is not acceptable for this platform. Anti-blackness is real important, and I've said, I know we have people that are new callers, and I've, you know, struggled with this, but I'm very comfortable. If you're a new caller, just dial back in and you'll remember that can't say coon on the cows or cooning or anything else or any name calling of black people. That's just not acceptable. I feel like that's a major, major problem, us name calling other black people and getting into conflict with other victims of racism. That's something we really got to work on. So I do mute people. Any name calling of black people or any use of any of the derivatives of cooning or any, they might come up with some new slogans. That's just going to be a mute. So the caller just ring back. It's not anything permanent. It's happened to other people, and they dial back in, and we move forward constructively. People do not agree with that policy. You certainly do not have to listen. Other folks who had commentary, is anybody that we missed who has commentary they would like to share? We get everybody? Great. I hope people do not wait until the last minute if you have commentary. Cynical African did have a racist joke that he overheard. CynicalAfrican.com posts a lot of material directly related to racism, white supremacy. His joke, I heard a conversation between a black male and a racist woman. The black male, have you ever had sex with a black guy? Racist woman, yes, the 21st guy I slept with was a black man. He was my blackjack. Both of them laughed. The interesting thing is that blackjack, yes, the game 21, and even her, the black male was the 21st guy that I slept with, the tackiness all the way around, but blackjack, that is also a weapon, interestingly, a weapon that is wrapped in black leather. I thought that was interesting, probably relevant, that association, that link, connection between sex and violence with whites is rampant. You'll see a lot of that at cynicalafrican.com, but he did give us a racist joke to share. A couple other things I wanted to get in really quick also. The segment about the strip searches at New York, that is probably one of the most painful clips that I've had to listen to on the compensatory call-in for a while. I didn't really hear commentary about that, but that is Daniel Holtzclaw came to mind. And people noticed on Facebook, I posted right at the end of December, they did an interview, it was pretty lengthy. It was like a 15-minute interview with his family. I had not seen his family before, so they had like his white father, race soldier, on talking about, oh, my child is innocent. They're showing all his baby pictures. Anyway, that was number one, Daniel Holtzclaw. And then the second thing like this is total terrorism, sexual terrorism. When I said, was rape a part of what was happening on this plantation? Because that is just ongoing, integral aspect of white culture, sexual terrorism against black people, black males, black females, black children, every day, all day activity. It was stunning. And I even think a huge aspect of that is to humiliate and abuse you and to devastate you and to sexually violate you so that you stop coming. If we can isolate, we got them isolated, greater confinement, then they'll have no contact with families. We've done story reports before about how they charge exorbitant. I mean, you talk about financially being raping people by charging astronomical fees for the phone calls from prison and the disruptions in the call. We hear that even the segments where we have Mumia Abu-Jamal on. It's to disrupt those relationships. They started that segment saying that this is their only outlet to the outside world. This is their only connection to a friendly face, somebody that cares about them, and we're going to terrorize them every time that they come here so that they will stop coming. I thought that was important as well, that did not necessarily get brought up. And I thought it was important that they kept saying this has been reported for years. Not ignorance, not that we haven't heard this. This gets reported all the time. We just find some way of lying or saying, oh, these, you know, they lied. That's what these niggers do. They're lying and smuggling drugs and blah, 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 blah. Extremely important segment. Although, again, that was one of the most painful clips that I've had to endure in a long time. That segment about Mark Wahlberg, the white male reporter, lied. Philip Martin with WGBH. He said that when Mark Wahlberg was terrorizing black people and non-white people in Boston, that it was during the busing crisis. That is a lie. The busing crisis was in the 70s. Mark Wahlberg was terrorizing people in the late 80s. They said 1987 and 1988. That is 10 years after the busing crisis. Now, if you're going to blame, and it's the same thing like you heard with Desmond Cole talking about in Canada, if it's going to be, we can find some way of explaining, and he grew up in a tough neighborhood, and it was just the influence and peer pressure, and he just had such a tough time. Affluenza all over again, anytime, regardless of what any white individual does, hey, we are not going to think about them as a criminal. But that's just facts. And I mean, this is a journalist. You're supposed to do your job. You live in Boston. You should know this information. I'm sure he knows this information. He's just practicing racism. If you want to compare something that would have been around the same time period, that would have been Charles Stewart, the white man who killed his pregnant wife and blamed it on a Negro, and they ransacked the whole black side of town before they found out, oh, this white guy lied and killed his wife and then committed suicide. That is around the same time as Mark Wahlberg. That would have been a correct comparison. Last thing, I did have a couple others, but the last thing, the segment where they were talking about white theft of black children with the white female actress from Sex and the City, Charlotte Goldenblatt. She said she went to school when she felt her abducted black child was not being allowed to play on the swing. She went to school and she said she talked like, yelled like a crazy person and was going up and down. And I was like, wow, that is white power. She said white privilege. And that is white power, that I can go here and yell and get outraged to defend my abducted black child when you have biological black mothers and black fathers who get tased, arrested, choked, banned from the school for doing the exact same thing. We just played that clip 2 weeks ago where a black mother, she got thrown on the ground, handcuffed, and arrested for trying to defend her black child. She is not ignorant about racism. It is not white privilege. That is flagrant white power. I will stop there. Anybody that we missed at all, or anybody had additional comments they wanted to share? We have about 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, we have about 20 minutes left. Anybody that has additional commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
And also to elaborate on your commentary about the women who go see their loved ones in prison where the guards are probing and prodding them, I suspect the white people who are the guards, when they get together amongst themselves, they talk about how to probe and prod women in more creative ways and probably laugh and joke about it. And as you said, it's pure terrorism.
Yeah. Other folks have commentary? Even if you are, I don't think we missed anybody. If you have a hand up, your line should be open. So I don't think we missed anybody unless you're just being quiet. But other folks have commentary they want to share? Anything else they want to touch on?
Hey, can I be here?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I wanted to bring up I know a few shows back you had the two non-white victims with white parents on the show to kind of talk about their mothers and experience. So I just wanted to talk about my sister. So my dad was in a tragic arrangement with a racist white woman, and they had offspring. So my sister, when I was younger, I would go visit her and kind of be with her white mother and her mother's husband. And, you know, when I was younger, I really didn't think anything of it. I was just like, you know, my sister visiting. They lived in Kansas, Wichita at the time. But she ended up running away at 19. And she had a child, and her mother took the child. And I'm not sure why she took the child. I kind of, you know, asked, but it was kind of like, you know, some stuff happened, and she just took the child, and she told me her mother was like, "You will never see this child again," and I'm gonna take her and just raise her, and you know, and she would tell me like when she was younger, her mother would call her nigger, and I remember I remember going one, because I visited her a few times, but I mean one summer we went, and her mother was making her like clean up the whole house, and but the house was like clean, so like kind of just reflecting, looking back, like she was making her like scrub the floor, get on her knees and scrub the floor, and I was like, I remember like asking myself, like, man, like the floor, like is like clean, like why is she making her, you know. And I remember her, like, yelling at her on the phone. So I definitely believe that her mother, her white racist mother, was mistreating her from, because she left my dad and was with her mother from 13 to 19. So I believe that whole time, you know, she was definitely being mistreated. And my mother recently just told me that my, you know, my non-white sister with a white parent told her that her mother at a young age told her that when you get older, you know, you date a black man, you know, don't date a white man, it'll just be easier for you. Also too, when my sister was 5, her mother came back and kidnapped her and took her down to Atlanta where she was living at the time, and my mother told me that, you know, they went down to get her, my dad, and that they was asking, like, the neighbors, you know, do they know, you know, this woman, and did she have a child? And the neighbors was like, oh, you know, we know her, but she doesn't have a child. She does have a, you know, someone, a little girl, but she says she's babysitting the girl. So, you know, this racist woman was telling her neighbors that, you know, this daughter of hers was someone that she was, you know, a child that she was babysitting. So I just wanted to, you know, tell that story to the listeners, and I didn't get a chance to call in that day, but that's you know, some stuff I've heard from having a non-white sister with a white parent, with her victimization. So that's all I had on that.
Wow, I mean, Tacky does not even accurately capture all of that. This is the same sister that her child is really good friends with this other white child, and she, I guess, and the white child's mom are close. Is this the same sister?
Nah, that's a different sister. That sister, my mom's daughter. So she's non-white, black victim.
Got it. Wow. Tragic. Dr. Welsing, what does she say consistently? We play around with sex, and certainly, I mean, that's putting it mildly. We're talking about a white person and any sort of sexual activity with a non-white person, but when we play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring, and that's what it's going to be, just having a race soldier as a parent to, you know, acutely mistreat you for life.
Can I be heard?
And confound your understanding. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, okay, finish your thought, guys.
Confound your understanding of racism, period.
Great observation, sir. I had a couple of things I wanted to bring up. First, in regards to my coworker with the child she had by this African male, the one thing that stood out as a Dr. Welsing moment in my conversation with her was she said that when the child was first born, the child was so pale, he was paler than her. And she is pale. She is extremely pale. And she said that at first she didn't think it was her child. So obviously there was an understanding that her genes are recessive, which they turned out to be in this child because he's obviously a black male and he looks like his father. So I just found that telling that she was thrown off with how pale he was. And she said it took him a few weeks before he started to gain some color. By the time I saw him, he was probably about maybe a shade lighter than President Obama. So I guess we'll see how he grows as she lets me know, so whatever the case may be. There was two commercials that I saw that incorporated racism, white supremacy in very slick ways that I don't know if anyone else has ever seen. There's an Optum internet service commercial, commercial, where there's these two white males and a black male driving to someone's house to move some material for this guy. We'll move stuff around his house. And on the way, the guy calls him because it's taking him a while to get there. So the white male answers the phone, and the person on the other end is complaining about how long it's taking them to get there. So at one point in the commercial, after he chides them for being late, the white guy says to the person who they're going to do the work at their house, he says, oh, thank you for giving us, you know, for giving us the opportunity to do this work or whatever. And then there's a overweight black male who says, wait, now how much work? And it was just that obvious, you know, fat black male, lazy, doesn't want to do his job. And it was just that quick at the end of the commercial. And they've used him twice in that capacity, where there was another commercial from the same company where he, again, did the, you know, overtly fat, lazy black male thing in the commercial. So it's just subtle. It's presented as comedy. But, again, it's that same stereotypical black people are lazy, especially fat black people are lazy kind of connotation. And then the other one was even more subtle. This one was actually a car commercial. It's one of those, I don't remember if it's a Lincoln, but it's like a, I guess like an SUV. And the guy who plays Negan from The Walking Dead is the guy whose voice is in the commercial. So it's just a car showing. And the guy says in the commercial, they're playing this this kind of cinematic violin kind of music to set the tone, and it's like the early wee hours of the morning, so it's still dark outside when the SUV is on the highway. And he says, you hear him say, the north and the south are mine, the east and the west are mine, and then it ends in a way where he says, the world is a beautiful place. And I'm like, you're speaking of manifest destiny, white people taking over the world, and because white people have taken over the world, it's a beautiful place. Now, that would be a very subtle thing that probably the average person wouldn't have caught, and it's something that comes on first thing in the morning when I'm watching the news to get the weather and stuff before I go to work. So it comes on quite regularly during that time of the morning when I'm preparing for work. And I just thought about it like, wow, this is something I wanted to throw out there. I don't know if anyone else has seen it, but I just wanted to throw those two things that I saw out there. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
I haven't seen either one of those commercials. I did see the Popeyes commercial, and I made a video of that. I was just going to post the commercial, but then I said I can, you know, invest a short period. We didn't have a program that day, so I said I can invest a few minutes and, you know, just add a quick analysis. That Popeyes chicken commercial featuring Jerry Rice, he's a Hall of Fame football player, retired Hall of Fame football player. He won lots of Super Bowls with the San Francisco 49ers and had a lengthy career. Melanated black male. He's in this Popeyes chicken commercial. And the thing that caught my attention originally was that they replaced his voice with the voice of a female. So, you know, just continued emasculation, contempt for gender against black people. You see this in a variety of ways, but if it's a black male, got to get him in a dress. Dave Chappelle talked about this. Get him in a dress, get some makeup on him, get a wig on him. They did this with Charles Barkley. They did this with DeAndre Jordan. And particularly, in my opinion, black athletes, where they are the prototype of masculinity. Like, oh yeah, DeAndre Jordan is about 7 feet tall, muscular, young, highly melanated, thick afro, and oh yeah, we definitely got to get him in a dress with blonde hair repeatedly, have bunches of commercials where we can project him in that manner. That was one, and then also a pattern after athletes retire, like Mike Tyson, Muhammad Ali, and they were great. Now we really, Charles Barkley, now we really want to embarrass them. Like, yeah, you might have got a few dollars, and maybe we weren't able to steal all of your nickels back yet, but we are going to make a total clown out of you. I've seen that pattern a lot, and it reminded me of that. There was more to the commercial than I even saw at first, because they do the replacement with his voice. Then the black female that he's talking to, she's surprised that he did a good job with this commercial. And so she says, I can't believe you did that. And he responds, he says, I'm a pro, not a professional, a pro. And if you can look in the dictionary for this, just saying pro, that is one of the synonyms for prostitute, short for prostitute. I thought that was interesting. It's one of those things, I think this came up in Gwen Ifill's book, where you can deliberately write something or use words in a manner that may convey different meanings to different people, depending on how they read it. That's what you do this deliberately. We don't want you to say professional. We want you to just say pro. And then finally, she says cut. Now, when I did my video edit of this, I put the chopping sound in, but she says cut at the end of the video. And then you see a white hand take the big brown football and move it off the screen, and they put the Popeyes logo up and everything. To me, symbolically, what it suggested was exactly what I titled the video, Castration of Jerry Rice, Black Male Jerry Rice, who was known for catching the balls. Many people say he's one of the greatest football players of all time, certainly one of the greatest wide receivers of all time, catching the ball. No, you're not going to have the ball. You're not even going to keep your balls. White hand with the big brown ball. Dr. Welsing all over it, and a lot of the stuff, it took me after I had to watch it and start working on the commercial, the editing part of it, that I saw a lot of that other stuff that was there. But that's one that I saw as well, where it just seems the racist messaging very intense in these little 30-second bursts. Anybody else? Commentary they wanted to get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I have observed some of the same things that you have, Gus, and I look at TV, when I do look at TV and commercials, with a very critical eye, and just as you have made your analysis about some of the observations that you've seen, I've also seen those as well, and I've also seen where they're either putting the black male with the blonde woman. One example is where this guy who is tasting this orange juice, I don't know if you've seen this, and the white woman talks about how good this orange juice is, and she tells the black guy to drop and give her 10. Then he tells her to drop and give him 10. And then they're also putting young black children, either black females with white males or black males with white women. And that sends to me that there's a message that we cannot lovingly get along with each other. We have to love somebody outside of being black to get along with each other. And that message is so insidious. And when young people look at these messages, there are subliminal messages being transmuted into their brain computers that they are not aware of.
I totally agree. Dr. Welsing talked about that a lot as well. Did we miss someone? It looked like someone dialed in. You got a hand up from a block?
Yeah, can I be heard? I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know if you'll be able to hear me very well. I got something going on. My clothes dryer is not working appropriately, and it's making a lot of noise. I just want to say about that homosexual thing. I was watching this video clip on Facebook, and they showed these two black guys, and it was professional football players, and one had got the other one down, and he purposely fondled his genitals. And I'm like, what? And it was like it was planned. It was like the whites probably told him to do that. Because, I mean, I don't watch football, but I used to have a boyfriend that loved football, and sometimes I watch it with him. And I'd never seen nothing like that before. I mean, this guy got him down, and then the guy stood up over him and just purposely fondled his genitals. And I'm like, he had to been told to do that. And everybody was, you know, complaining about that video. Also, I just want to say one more thing, too, about that with that guy that they were talking about up in Canada that was robbing banks, and they was talking about him like, oh, poor little me, whatever. Here on the West, here on the East Coast, I guess when they had a lot of wildfires, and the police didn't know who was committing all these wildfires, and they was going after him, and then they found out it was some 23-year-old white guy that was starting these wildfires, and he was putting them on Facebook, and the cops were saying, oh, he's just a kid. They was bored. He didn't have nothing to do. So he wanted to have something to put on Facebook. So he was starting all these wildfires. And they act like it was nothing wrong with it. Like, it was no big deal. I'm like, I can't believe it. And a lot of people lost their homes. Some people died in these fires and stuff. And, I mean, if they're white, I don't care if they did die. But I'm just saying, I mean, you know, double standard, big time. Sorry if that's a metaphor. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Mr. Steele, were you going to?
Yeah. Real quick, regarding the – can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello? Okay. Yeah, regarding the homosexuality discussion that's been taking place, I read an interesting article that I posted in a group that I maintain, that they were planning on
Did we lose the caller?
It sounded like his connection was not.
Or that there are.
Mr. Steele, your connection is breaking up a lot.
Hello?
We missed. Yes, we can hear you now, but your connection was really bad. Like, we were not able to hear you at first.
Okay, I'm traveling through mountains currently, so I might have a bad connection.
I would concur. You have a bad connection, at least for right now. And we're not able to hear you anymore at this point.
Can I be heard still?
Okay, we can hear you now. Now we can't hear you. Oh, well. We'll have to pick it up for next week. Just make a note, or you can call it tomorrow for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism and share it then, or just make a note. Or actually, we'll be on Monday. You'll have lots of opportunities. We'll be on regularly. I think we'll be on every day for the next week except for Tuesday. So you'll have lots of opportunities to share. Anybody else? Anything they wanted to get in before we get ready to conclude? Last couple minutes?
I sent you an email. Can you confirm if the address that I'm going to send the money to is correct? Can you just reply to my email when you get a chance?
Oh, absolutely. Let me wrap things up here, and I will get back to you.
Okay.
I was going to say, Gus, I saw that commercial with Jerry Rice, and I thought it was some of the same things you brought up. I'm glad you did bring that up because I didn't think about it tonight. But, it was the emasculation is just really, really ridiculous. And I like that you brought up the use of the word pro and how, like you were saying, that we can have a discussion and a phrase might be used or words might be used and there's two different meanings being conveyed to two different groups of people, of course, one being the white supremacists, the others being the black people or non-white people that are in earshot of the message. And it just made me think of something as simple as the criminal justice system and the way that term is used. You know, we think it stands for the area of people activity having to do with law, but it's really saying that criminals are running the justice system. So they're telling us basically flat in our faces that they are criminals and they're running the justice system, but we're taught to interpret it as just the criminal justice system because it's just used in such a bland way where it just becomes like an everyday phrase that you just say, but we don't think about the ramifications of criminals running the justice system, which has been our entire experience. And that's it. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Right on. I think Student for Justice, he's going to do our prayer to wrap things up. I did not forget. I did want to get in. I'll have to give thanks to Dr. Cambon. He had really great suggestion. This technically could be workplace racism, but I wrote for Atlanta Black Star for a while, enough content. I think the article that retired firefighter referenced about the impossibility of an ignorant white person wrote at Atlanta Black Star, and it was I just had concerns in terms of the working partnership at the time, and I spoke with Dr. Cambon about the best way to proceed. And number one, I think Emmy, formerly 1842, and others, we just talked about on workplace racism the importance of if you're going to transition and move on to a different job or what have you, to do so in a professional manner. And even though you might want to curse and stomp and, you know, name call and do all that, that probably is not the best thing. That, you know, in the system of white supremacy, white people, they find ways to retaliate for that sort of thing. And with victims, just on, you know, us, as I stated before, working on not being anti-black and minimizing conflict, you definitely don't want to do it with the black people. Just, hey, move forward. And what Dr. Cambon said specifically was, well, it might not be a correct time now. You all can preserve the relationship, move forward, and it might be a better thing down the road in the future. And I took his advice. I did not act a fool. I didn't curse anybody out or say anything bad. Just very appreciative, which I was, for the opportunity. I did get to write some things that I wanted to write. People appreciated it. Move forward. They actually contacted me to ask to write more. And I got every concern that I had that caused me to stop writing was corrected. So I got everything I wanted. And that was just Dr. Cambon. Don't act a fool. Maybe at a later date, this would be better. Right on to Dr. Cambon, and that's one that I would give out. Just you can use that for workplace racism across the board. Just being a professional counter-racist soldier. We already have enough problems. You will have ample opportunity for combat in the system of white supremacy. We just want to make sure that we pick appropriate spots to do so, particularly not with other non-white people, really, for any reason. You can, you know, just try to minimize that as best you can and maybe even mend and repair things as we go with that relationship with other non-white people. So, all that to say, if you have other topics, I did the same thing before. Now that I will have opportunity to write lots more, I get to write even more than I was writing the first time around. So if you have ideas, things that you think would be something good to write on, something to focus on, let me know. I will get to write lots more. And I am doing even news pieces. So if there's something local, something happening, let me know, and we'll see if we can write it up. Other than that, we'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We'll be looking forward to hearing from victims, listeners in different parts of the globe. We'll be here Monday, Black female in North Carolina discussing racism, white supremacy with her housing situation to tell some of the things. Came up again, managing our emotions. You got to be a professional counter-racist soldier because they were definitely trying to bait her to being emotional and to, as they say, losing her cool, which she did not do. But that'll be Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and Pam, racismws.com, Trojan Horse Publications. She'll return this Wednesday. That's the 18th, I believe, 2 days before the inauguration. Normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll discuss the pending Trump presidency, the end of the Obama era, her thoughts on the end of 2016, other things related to counter-racism. Will be great to hear from Pam. Once again, if you have questions, confusions, gripes, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, Student for Justice, thank you for your patience. Thank you kindly for the investment. As I said, give me 30 seconds once we wrap up and I will reply to the email. Take it away with a prayer, sir.
Creator, black people are in a system of racism, white supremacy. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator, help black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and to guarantee that no black person is mistreated and to guarantee that the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, thank you for the brilliant Dr. Francis Cress Welsing in my lifetime. Creator, help black people to resolve and remedy the problems of racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately. Be well to all in 2017.
Ashe. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.